question in mind, let's take a moment to observe the five precepts. Please repeat after me.
Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Saranagamanam sampunnam. Panatipata veramani sikha padam samadhyami. Adinnadana veramani sikha padam samadhyami. Kamesu micchachara veramani sikha padam samadhyami. Musavada veramani sikha padam samadhyami. Suramera majjapama dattana veramani sikha padam samadhyami. Tisaranena saddhim panchasilam dhammam sadukham surakkitam katva appamadena sampadeta.
Okay, you may all be seated now. Most venerable members of the Mahasangha, venerable nun, members of the audience, as well as those of you listening to this sermon online. Before we commence, let us all take a moment to invite all the devas, brahmas, spirits, demons and the dead to join us. It is now our opportunity to repay our debts to those that we owe them to. In this infinitely long journey in samsara, many innumerable, incalculable beings we have come past, beings who have been mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, relations to us and helped us in many different ways. There are lots of debts that we owe them, and this is now our prime opportunity to repay those debts. Let us give them the gift of Dhamma, the gift that excels all gifts. And if there are beings among them who are today born in the woeful plains, may they be able to rejoice in this meritorious event. May they be able to witness this meritorious deed and rejoice in those merits, so that they may be able to redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. And may all those beings in the blissful planes may be able to listen to this sermon, understand it, comprehend it, and be able to redeem themselves from the shackles of samsara. So, as I now make a connection you might have had to them, whatever debts you might owe them, let us make this opportunity to invite them to join us, and may they rejoice in this meritorious event.
Samanta chakravalesu atra gacchantu devata sadhammam munirajasansa sunantu sagga mokkhadam dhamma savana kalo ayam වදන්තා ධම්ම සවන කාලෝ අයං භදන්තා ධම්ම සවන කාලෝ අයං භදන්තා
And also before we commence, let us all be humble enough to acknowledge that we are not the people we used to be. We used to be very different people before the Dhamma touched our lives. If that is who we used to be, and you may be able to recall from your early years in this life, imagine what you might have been in this infinitely long journey in samsara, how you might have conducted yourselves, how we might have conducted ourselves with each other, as well as our conduct towards the noble ones, the Samma Sambuddhas, the Paccheka Buddhas, the Arahatta Buddhas, Anagami, Sakrudagami, Sotapannas, be they on the path of having attained the fruits, as well as the Buddha's ministry, the Sambuddha Shasane. There may have been plenty of times where we have offended them, abused them, slandered them and desecrated them. Any words, actions or thoughts of desecration and abuse that we might have directed towards the noble ones as well as the Buddha's ministry may today hinder, block our progress in the Dhamma. Therefore, prior to us commencing, let us all take a moment sincerely, honestly, genuinely to ourselves, acknowledging and accepting we are not all saints, we didn't used to be, accepting that there may be have plenty of times, might have been plenty of times where we will have done so. Let us all take a moment to seek forgiveness from the noble ones. And finally, let us all make a firm resolve that through the course of this sermon, if there are any gaps in your understanding which are keeping you from attaining the first attainment, the first noble attainment of Sotapanna, may through the course of this sermon you be able to fulfill those gaps. And if there are any among you who have already attained the state of Sotapanna, may through the course of this sermon you'll be able to fulfill the subsequent stages and be able to attain the bliss of Nibbana. So, with that firm resolve and determined in mind, I invite you all to prepare yourselves to listen to this sermon. I was informed that a good many of you have put forward your names for the first meditation program. Well done. But at the same time, you must make sure, you must make certain that you are ready for it. Otherwise, you're going to be wasting your time. And otherwise, what you once liked the sound of, you might begin to resent. Because when you come and you start doing your meditation, if you feel like you're not getting anywhere, if you feel like this Dhamma is not making sense, I really don't know what I'm doing right now, sat on my backside, I have been for the last 2.5 hours, nothing's happened, then you're gonna start to resent. So we must ensure that you don't fall into that trap, because what can happen then is you become disheartened and then you stop coming along to sermons as well. So you'll dig your own grave by doing that. So you have to all be very careful. We mustn't be hasty. In achieving our goal, what we must be hasty in is doing the things that we need to do to get to our goal. Because once we have the courses lined up, there is nothing you need to do to achieve the result. The result will look after itself. Is the aircon working? Is it? Doesn't feel like it. So ask yourselves, are you ready? Are you doing what you need to do to prepare yourselves? So ask yourself that question. If you're not ready just yet, that's okay, because we still have time. But you have to do the things that I have been asking you to do, which is go back and listen to the previous sermons. If you haven't been doing that, and if you don't intend on doing it, then, well, you have been warned. I genuinely mean this, okay? Because I was quite overwhelmed, really, by the number of responses that we got back. I didn't expect so many of you to put your names forward. And I don't know if there are those among you who have put your names forward and who don't generally come and listen to the sermons. So I don't know that I haven't gone through the list, checking things off, because I don't know any of you by name. So I don't know who you are. I just see some familiar faces regularly, and that's about it. So you have to check you're ready. And what if you're not? What if you're not ready? You can either come later, or you can prepare yourself. You can make yourself ready. There's still time. So throughout the next few sermons, I will try to focus on the core of what we will be focusing on, we'll be concentrating and reflecting on during our meditation programs, which is anicca, dukkha and anatta. Because, you know, this is what we need to really get a firm grip on. This is what transformed you from a putakjana into a sotapanna. Anicca, dukkha and anatta, nothing else. You can be the most generous person alive. You can be the most meritorious person ever. But that is not going to transform you into an arya. You know, there are clubs that people have, right? In society there are clubs. Some clubs are quite exclusive. Only the privileged can join them. Yeah? You're probably members of some of them. You have to be quite privileged to join them. You know, there are several levels of membership. Standard members, silver members, gold members, diamond and platinum members, and things like that, right? So you're probably members of some of those clubs. These are called exclusive clubs because not everyone can join them. Well, as I was happening to think recently, there is one club that is very exclusive, the most exclusive club you can ever find. The most exclusive club that you can ever find. It is that of Shravaka Sangha. The club of Aryans. It is so extremely exclusive. It doesn't matter how much money you have, you can't join it. It doesn't matter how powerful you are, you can't join it. It doesn't matter how educated you are, how much property you have to your name, how young or old you are, you simply can't join it. It doesn't matter how many friends you've got, you simply can't join it. You can only be included in this club by invitation. And that invitation has to come from someone who is also a member. This is why this is so exclusive, this club. You cannot become a Shravaka Sangha unless someone who is also a Shravaka Sangha, or the Buddha himself, who is the founding member of this club, gives you an invitation. A personal invitation. And that imitation comes in the form of what? Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. Would you like to become members of this exclusive club? It's nice to be a member of an exclusive club, isn't it? Because then you feel special. You could be the Sakradeva and you can't join this club if you haven't received an invitation from someone who is also a member. You could be the Mahabrahman, but you still can't join it. Because membership of this club requires only one prerequisite, and that is your comprehension of Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. You can't simply memorize it, you can't simply learn it, you have to comprehend it. Once you've comprehended it, now you are a member. And there is nothing else you need to do either. You become automatic members, and guess what? Most clubs you are members of, they give you lifetime membership. Yeah? This club, you get membership for the rest of samsara. So, quite a lot of benefits. And you know the biggest benefit? They take away your citizenship. To become a member of this club, you have to let go, you have to give up your citizenship. Of where? Where? The four great hells. You have to give up your citizenship of the four great hells. Aren't we all here on a visa? Yeah. We are all here on a visa. This visa can expire at any moment. Unfortunately, you don't know what expiry date is stamped on this visa. And also, based on your behavior, sometimes they might terminate your visa while it's still valid. Some karmas, they're very powerful. So powerful that you could go back to where you came from in the next thought. That's all that is required. So, if you're willing to surrender your citizenship of the four great hells, then it's worth considering taking membership of this club, because you can't take membership while you still hold on to that citizenship. And, as I said, you have to be invited by someone who's also a member, either the founding member or someone who joined this subsequently as a result of invitations having received from the founding member. Making sense so far? So this is a pretty exclusive club. There is no club that is more exclusive than this. And if you count all the sentient beings out there, membership of this club is very rare. In fact, probably the most rare membership of all clubs there ever is, and there ever was, and there ever will be. All other clubs will have more members than this club. The club of Aryans. The club of Shravaka Sangha, not Sammuti Sangha, not conventional Sangha. Once you're in a robe, you're a member of the conventional Sangha. All that's required for that is to shave your head, don a robe, and get hold of an alms bowl. And you're a member of the conventional Sangha. But it's not so easy to become a member of the Shravaka Sangha. Would you fancy membership of that? Yes? Good. Let's try and get you a membership. It's quite slick, isn't it, to be a member of an exclusive club? Then they don't check how much money you have in your bank balance either. They don't check what car you drive. Some clubs you have to drive a posh car, otherwise they don't let you in. Some clubs you have to be fluent in English, otherwise they don't let you in. Some clubs you have to come in black tie, otherwise they don't let you in. In your suits and in your boots, otherwise they don't let you in. But this club, it doesn't matter how you come. You can come in rags for all you like, because there's only one requisite, and that is your comprehension of Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. And once you are a member of this club, from there on you can enhance your membership. There are several grades of membership. So first you become a standard member. What is that called? Sotapanna. Then you become a silver member. More privileges. As you keep enhancing your membership, there are more privileges. The greatest privilege is there's less suffering as you keep going forward. Then you can become a gold member. So what was silver membership? Sakrudagami. And gold membership? Anagami. Finally, yes, you come to a platinum member. What is that called? Arahat. Your purpose of joining this club should be to achieve that platinum membership. Shall we check your cards? Do you have your membership card with you? Well, hurry up. This should be your sole purpose of visiting this monastery. Simply put it, that should be your sole purpose. Everything else you do while you're here is auxiliary, additional stuff. You could bring us alms, that's all additional stuff. It's just stuff. That should not be your purpose of being here, of visiting us. Your purpose of visiting us should solely be getting membership of this club. And once you become a platinum member, you don't have to be here anymore. In fact, once you become a standard member, you don't really have to be here. Because from there you can work on your membership yourself and you can enhance your membership one grade at a time. But once you're a platinum member, then really you don't have to be here. And besides, once you've become a standard member, you can invite other members to join us. Because this happens by word of mouth. Exclusively by invitation only. Do you like the sound of that? Yeah. And you thought you had to give up everything. No, no, no. You actually receive membership of this club. That's a fantastic thing. The most exclusive club ever. So in order to get into this club and in order to enhance your membership as you go forward, there are certain things that we have to be careful of. So I've been speaking to a few of our visitors over the last week or so, and most of them are regular listeners. So having spoken to them, there are a few things I'm picking up on which I thought I should probably talk to you a little bit about, because if I don't say the things I'm about to say, then it might block your progress. You might go AWOL. You might go astray. And then you will not be able to achieve what it is you're here to achieve. Because, you know, if you're anything like me, when you start this journey, I started off as a non-believer. That's how I started. Don't believe. Buddha? Don't believe. Dhamma Sangha? No, don't believe. Karma Vipaka? Don't believe. I was a don't believer. I didn't believe. I was a non-believer. That's how a lot of us will have started. And generally, the more you have, material-wise, the more this is going to be people's mindset. Very rarely there's the odd exception where people are both materially rich as well as spiritually. But generally what happens is when you're materially rich, then spirituality goes out the back window. That's a shame. Because people then seek refuge in materialism. People seek refuge in wealth, knowledge, and power. So if you're anything like me, I started off as a non-believer. There are two types of non-believers. There's one type of non-believer, he doesn't believe because he just doesn't know. I don't know, so I don't believe. Do you believe in the Buddha? Seriously, I don't know who the Buddha is, so I can't help it but not believe because I don't know who the Buddha is. That's one type of non-believer. There's another type of non-believer. These non-believers are more dangerous to themselves as well as others because they are self-confessed non-believers and they are proud about it. I'm a non-believer and I'm proud of it. because of their mammoth egos. I'm a non-believer and I'm proud of it. I don't believe in karma vipaka and I'm so proud of it. Some people are like that. Some people are like that. They like a bit of a debate. You know, give me what you've got. Throw me whatever you've got and I'll fight you off because I am a non-believer and I'm proud of it. Some people are like that. You will come across people like this in society. I don't believe in the Buddha. I don't believe in the Dhamma. What is it? Just, you know, we just go through life. Right? There's no need for a philosophy. There's no need for a religion. If you have money, if you have a place to stay, if you have a family, then that's all you need. There's no need for spirituality in lives. You know, there are people like that. I don't believe in karma vipaka, no devas, brahma, you know, there are none of these beings, no hells. I don't believe in it and I'm proud of it. There are some people like that. They're very dangerous, not just to themselves but also to others, because they're like an epidemic disease that starts spreading. Infectious. Because every person they touch will be infected by this disease. Because they're proud about the fact that they're a non-believer, and one of their motives of existence is really to spread that belief among other people so that they have a bigger clan. Very dangerous. But chances are, a lot of us, this is the path that we took. First we were a non-believer because we just simply didn't know. Then we started to hold on to our opinions and strongly hold on to our opinions, and therefore along with ego to back it up, we became proud non-believers. And then after a while you get to listen to something. You might not want to call it a Dhamma. You get to listen to something that somebody says that gets you to start thinking. It breaks a lot of views that you have about the world. It changes your perspective on the world. It challenges the view that you hold about the world. It's a paradigm shift. Now slowly you start to become a believer. With convincing along the way, slowly you start to become a believer. But sometimes this belief can come with faith, in the disguise of faith. Believing in something and faith are really not one and the same, I like to think. Because faith comes with, there's a really sad word that usually gets thrown around with faith, and that's the word blind. Blind faith. Because first, this was a non-believer, then went on to become an adamant non-believer and proud of it, and then faith, but blind faith. Through some kind of convincing, hey, you shouldn't be like that, you know, there are the hells. Ooh. Be scared, hells. You're going to die. Be scared. Blind faith. I'm not saying believing in hells is blind faith. I'm saying this is how some people are transformed. By talking to them about hells. Yes, people have to be informed about hells because that is something that you should know, because you have to prepare yourself for it. At least to try and avoid getting there. But I personally don't believe that's the best way to get someone to the Dhamma. Even today, earlier on, this morning, a group of people came along, some visitors from abroad, and they wanted to have a chat. Although Buddhists by birth, they don't believe in a lot of the things that we talk about. No belief in hells or heavens. And what I explained to them is, I'm not going to talk to you about heavens and hells because I don't believe in them myself. At which they let go, they sigh relief. Ah, thank you. Because now, they don't have to throw up this obstacle, this wall that comes up. Immediately you see a Swami Vahanse, and you think either they're going to ask you for something, right? Or they're going to start talking to you gibberish that you don't understand. Things that you have to take by blind faith or out of fear or respect. None of these things is how the Buddha transformed a non-Buddhist to a Buddhist. I was quite sad. I think last week I met this gentleman who said there are two people that he has come to fear in life. Two types of people. Because when you meet them, they're always going to ask you for something. Ask you for something you don't like to give. The first type, he said, are policemen. And the second, unfortunately, are monks. I felt sick to the core just listening to him say that. With a robe around my body, I felt it's just such a shame that we have to. And there's nothing wrong in what he said. It is the truth. He spoke very honestly and genuinely, and that is the reality. But it's a very pitiful reality. It's a very shameful reality. You will all have experience of that, more or less. So what should we do? Go and protest? With our placards in our hands? Walk around Lipton Square? Or sign a petition and send it off to the parliament? You know, the more the Dhamma sinks into my heart, into my mind, the more I realize it's not about changing the outside world. It's about changing oneself. I have to learn to be at peace with the world, not change the world to be at peace with me. That's what I used to try and do. Change the world. Make it a better place. Was it? Heal the world. Make it a better place for you and for me. Nah, I've given it up. I've given up on that ambition. Now it's about heal myself. To make the world a better place. Still, you are making the world a better place. But by not healing the world, by healing myself. Did I tell you the other day? Two people, one guy says to the other, "Hey, would you take care of me, please? If you love me, if you have affection towards me, then take care of me. Look after me." The other guy, he's clever, he's wise. He says, "I'm not going to look after you. I'm not going to take care of you, but I'll take care of myself for you." Very profound. So deep. I will look after myself for you. I will take care of myself for you. What does that mean? If there's no one around you who harms you, who hurts you, is there anything you need to worry about? Is there anything you need to fear? No. So if everyone around you looks after themselves, heals the wound inside of them, treats the wound inside of them, extinguishes the fire of raga, dvesha, moha inside of them, then do you need to worry about being around them? Do you have to be fearful of being around them? Do you have to worry about being around them? No. So that is what he meant. I will look after myself for you. That's what we should all be doing. Look after ourselves for the other person. Children, this is what you should do on behalf of your parents. Look after yourself, because then bringing you up is going to be far less troublesome. It's going to be a lot easier on your parents if you look after yourself. The reason that parents have to struggle so much is because children don't look after themselves. From simple things like brushing your teeth. from a very worldly perspective to supra-mundane perspectives, like attaining Nibbana. You know, you can start small, start brushing your teeth regularly. That's one less thing now your mother has to worry about. Make sure you wash your underwear every day. That's one less thing your dad has to worry about. Make sure you polish your shoes every day before you go to school. That's one less thing your parents have to worry about. Make sure you don't eat, you don't snack on these sugary foods, things like that. Make sure you keep to a good diet. That's one less thing your parents will have to worry about. Again, aren't you looking after yourself for them? So if each and every one of us would just look after ourselves a little bit more. Don't think of this as being selfish. I think this is the most selfless thing to do. Look after yourself so that you become less of a trouble to other people. Heal the wound inside so that you become less of a trouble to other people. Are you not shameful if I were to ask someone you know and ask them, what is the bane of your life? If I were to ask someone, what is the bane of your life? In other words, what is it that troubles them most? And if you are on their list, how would that make you feel? It could be your employer. It could be your employees. It could be your husband, your wife, your parents, your children. And ask them, what is it that troubles you most? And if you're on that list, how do you feel about that? You shouldn't be feeling good about that. That's one list you shouldn't be proud about having your name on. So you can get your name off of that list if you only looked after yourself. Because we now have an opportunity to look after ourselves. We are intelligent people. We have the power of thought. And we have the power of putting thoughts into action. To do good to ourselves. Doing good to ourselves is really doing good to the world around us. Do we not all need merit to get to our final destination? Which is what? What is our final destination? Andromeda? No, Nibbana. To get to Nibbana, we should all earn merit. And how can you earn merit? By doing good to you, yourself? Doing good to others. So you do merit to get yourself to Nibbana, but in doing so, what are you also doing? You're doing good to others. You're doing good to the world. There's going to be a day when you no longer need any merit. When that day comes, everything you do will be for the benefit of others. But until such time, look after yourself until your wound has been healed. Once your wound is healed, then you don't have to ask me, what should I do now? It'll all become obvious. Until your wound is healed, you will need instruction. Not for anything else, but to heal the wound. The wound of desire, aversion and delusion. These are the wounds that we ought to heal. So, non-believer went on to become an adamant non-believer. And then, once they came across the Dhamma touched their lives. These views that they hold on to strongly, skepticisms that they held on to very strongly, were broken, shattered. Now they begin to start to see the world quite differently to how they used to. That's a really good thing, is it not? Absolutely. It's a marvelous thing. Something that very rarely someone is able to achieve in their lives. But that's not the end of the journey. You've hardly begun. Because I'll tell you what happens next. Remember, I'm not talking about a sotapanna. I'm talking about someone who has not permanently given up on their views about the world. Someone who is willing to consider. So they've gone from being an adamant skeptic to someone who's willing to consider, willing to listen to the Dhamma, willing to consider who the Buddha might be, willing to change and transform their lives. So now you have a motivated explorer. They want to discover, a motivated discoverer. They want to discover themselves, they want to explore the world, they are now motivated because you have motivated them. Or they have listened to someone who has motivated them. And again, these motivated people, they are twofold. Motivation is good. But what happens if you have a motivated fool? That's very dangerous. A motivated fool is very dangerous. Because they have the enthusiasm to do a lot of work, to do stuff. They just want to get on with it. Right? We say Nibbana. Yeah. When? Can I do it yesterday? That's the question they have. They want to have attained Nibbana yesterday. That's how eagerly they want to do this. Because they don't realize that there's a path that gets you there. That this is a journey that you have to tread very carefully until you get to your destination. Ask yourself where you are on this journey. Because when you become motivated, but without direction and instruction, now what's going to happen is, because you've gotten taste of there's something new, something exciting, something interesting that I can now engage myself in, you're going to start running like a headless chicken. Have you seen a headless chicken? Go and look in the mirror. If you are motivated but without direction, you are like a headless chicken. Very dangerous. It's particularly on the path, on the quest of Nibbana. Because what can happen then is now you go to several teachers. You go to several people for instruction. And they're all correct. It's like, have you heard the expression, several cooks? Yes. Spoil the broth. Several cooks spoil the broth. Too many cooks spoil the broth. They all have a recipe for the broth. And they all have it. But what might happen is, you start reading the recipe of cook number one. You go a third of the way through the recipe and then now you think, I want something a little bit more exciting. Now you go to cook number two. And you continue from that point forward. So you continue from one third of the way forward, now you start reading that recipe book. Then again, a little way through, you decide, I want something new, something interesting, something exciting. Because remember, deep seated inside our minds is the desire to know, curiosity. To know, to find out, to know more about the world. And the world includes the Dhamma. Remember, the Dhamma is also part of the world. An arahant is not even attached to the Dhamma. You might have an arahant who does not understand the words of Paticchasamuppada. They'll have comprehended Paticchasamuppada, but not the words of it. Perhaps to you and I, when someone says the word avidya paccaya, sankara, sankara paccaya, vijnana, and you go, what's after that? What comes after that? So you just can't wait because it's interesting. It's really interesting. So you want to know, you want to find out. But you say those words to an arahant, you can stop wherever you like. They're not going to be curious to ask you what comes next. You can stop that teledrama at any episode and an arahant is not going to vex. But if someone leaves you on a cliffhanger, that's not so fun. So the same applies on your quest in the Dhamma, on your quest for Nibbana. Because now, if you've been listening to sermons, not just here but anywhere, right, you will have this desire to attain Nibbana. Whether you know exactly what Nibbana is or not, you will want to get there because it's interesting. Not everyone's doing it. Okay, so it becomes exclusive simply because of that. To be exclusive is a really nice thing. Right? Because then it means I can put myself above others. I'm not saying you are like this. All I'm saying is, be careful, because you could fall into this pit. I'm not saying any of you are there. I'm just saying, watch out. Because then in your need to know, in your desire to want to find out, what you're going to do is you're going to start going to all these cooks who have their own recipe books, and you're going to start taking bits from all of these recipe books, and then you're going to make your own broth. Just think about the last time you cooked a curry. Okay? Have you ever cooked a curry? Some of the ladies and gentlemen in the room looking, how do you cook a curry? Your privilege, that's why. So when you cook a curry, right, you start off by collecting all the ingredients you need, making sure you have all of that. Then you put the fire, turn on the fire, put the cooking pan on top, and then now you follow your recipe, right? So what if, as you start cooking your, let's say you're cooking dal curry, okay? Once you started cooking, imagine at some halfway through this experience, you taste it, just to check what it's like. Now it's a bit too salty. Okay, those of you who have cooked dal curry, can you please tell me, what do you do if your dal curry is turning out to be a little bit too salty? What do you do then? Add some? Onions. What else? Potatoes? Anything else? See? They excel. Exactly. You're proving my point. Some of you say, you'll add onions. Others say, you add potatoes. Someone might say, well, I just add a little bit more water to dilute the salt. Okay? So you're writing down your recipe as you go along. This is how I cook my dal curry. So in your recipe book, you're going to have this much salt. Okay? But because it's too salty, later down the line, you added something else to take away the too much saltiness. To reduce the saltiness, you added something else later on in your recipe. Now, you give this recipe to somebody else. So they to help them read the recipe and start to learn to cook dal curry. But they decide, I'm only going to take the first half and not going to bother about the rest of it. For the rest of the second half, they're going to borrow a recipe from somebody else, to whom it wasn't too much salt that they added. They added too much chili powder at the beginning. So to turn that around, to save their curry with too much chili powder, they might have added maybe coconut milk. Yeah? They might have added some coconut milk. Now you take the first half of the first recipe and the second half of the second recipe, and you make up your own recipe. Well, you can imagine what's going to happen. You're going to end up with a dal curry that not even your dog can eat. Whose fault is it? Is it cook number one's fault or cook number two's fault? Neither of them. Because they both have really good tasting dal curries. Because if you followed the instruction from top to bottom, you would have ended up with a decent enough dal curry. In both cases. But what you did was take one half from the first chef and the second half from the second chef, and you made up your own dal curry. This is what can also happen on your practice in the Dhamma. The Buddha founded 84,000 discourses, each of which teaches Nibbana. Each of them teaches the path to Nibbana. And depending on who it is, because why 84,000? Why did he not just give one sermon? I mean, Dhammasak Pavatam Sutta, that's one. You could have just stopped there. Because there are different mindsets. People have different mentalities. Right? Depending on whether you are Shraddha, Virya, Sati, Samadhi, Prajna, depending on what your faculty is that you are most strong in, then there's a different discourse that is right for you. And because the Buddha has what is called the Indriya Paro Pariyatta Jnane, which is a knowledge with which he can scan you, quite literally, and he knows how much
Shraddha, how much virya, how much sati, how much samadhi, how much pragna you have. He knows it to the T. What he can then do is give you a prescription. This is the discourse that you need to attain Nibbana. So depending on that, you will find either lay people or monks or nuns. You know, they'll all have a way that makes sense. So we talk about Udayangama Tangama Ashwada Adino Nissarana. Someone else might go along the path of Paticca Samuppada. Ultimately, they're all one and the same. Ultimately, this is how you cook a dal curry. Others might follow Abhidhamma to get there. Right? These are all paths to Nibbana. But what if you decide to do is take one bit of the first, second bit of something else, and the third bit of something else, and now make up your own, that is wrong. That is going to take you awol. It's going to get you lost. Because mainly the reason for that, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, you all live very busy lives. Okay? So, a lot of your time is spent just trying to make ends meet. Or, you know, just get through life, get through the day, attending to all your chores, right? Fulfilling your duties and responsibilities. So you don't really have the time to go and investigate and explore the Dhamma. Therefore, you trust in us to do that discovery, to do the study and give you the Dhamma in a way that you find is digestible, that you can make sense of. And it's okay to trust in us to do that. But remember, never be a follower. Or rather, never be a follower, always be a student. Okay, I say that all the time. Always be a student, not a follower. But because the path to Nibbana is the same for all of us, for everyone. And the path to Nibbana, the way that each of us follows that path can be slightly different. So therefore, if you start taking bits of each of these instructions and now start to make up your own, now that can be quite dangerous. Because what you've created for yourself is a recipe for disaster, not a recipe for dal curry. It's a recipe for disaster. So watch out. This is not me saying you should only listen to these sermons. I would hate to say something like that. That's disgusting, quite shameful in fact. That's not saying you should only come here and listen to sermons. That's not what I'm saying. You're free to make your own choices. What I'm saying is, find one teacher. Listen to their instruction and see if you can see the end. Can you see the light at the end of the tunnel? Until you see the light at the end of the tunnel, there's no point starting to walk because this could be a dead end. Then you have wasted 10, 20, 15 years of your life walking in this tunnel which has no escape. It's a dead end. So before you start walking the path of Nibbana, you must check if with using this instruction you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And if you have seen the light at the end of the tunnel, then I would suggest stick to that teacher. Stick to that teacher. Until circumstances change. It may be that you no longer can take their instruction. It may be that they no longer give instruction. If circumstances change, then perhaps you can look for another teacher. But if not, my best advice would be stick to one teacher and follow their instruction. Because more than anything else, you all have busy lives, okay? So you don't have time to experiment, do you? No. How many sutras do you read a day? How many sermons do you listen to every day? How many hours of meditation do you do every day? Well, you have the answer. If you are someone who's free, who has a lot of time, then you're very privileged. You're very privileged to be in that situation, but barely anyone is. Okay? So, if you are taking instruction from someone, I would suggest take instruction from one person or one teacher and then follow that instruction. If it's starting to sound like, actually, no, this teacher is talking nonsense, he's not talking raga ke, dvesha ke, moha ke, then
it's time to reconsider. I think I have said this plenty of times to you. Day that comes where whatever I am saying is igniting the fire of desire, aversion and delusion in your hearts and in your minds, that's the day you should stop coming here. Don't come here again. I emphasize that. Don't come here again. Because if that is the case, then I'm not talking to you about Nibbana. I'm not talking to you about the gift of that the Buddha came into this world to give. So, please be careful in your practice. Because I think I told you last week, this has become a franchise. Buddhism has become a franchise. Now it's like popping up mushrooms. Nowadays, thanks to technology, anyone can get on the internet. And usually when it's on the internet, you trust it. You know, if there's a fancy website to go along with it. These are things that buy people's trust. And if you can get some ratings from somebody, some thumbs ups, then you begin to trust immediately. A few 5-star reviews, that's enough. How did you pick which airline to fly? You spoke to a few people, went up on the website, checked some reviews, right? TripAdvisor, TravelAdvisor, these websites, and then you decided that's the airline I'm going to fly. So you based your decision on someone else's opinion. And that's okay when it comes to worldly endeavors. But when it comes to Nibbana, you have to know for yourself. Because it's not somewhere you can get through blind faith. It has to come with conviction. Otherwise, you're wasting your human life. You're wasting human life, which is probably the only chance you're going to get to the other side. Which airline you fly, you can decide any day. So watch out and be very careful. Because people, you know, just as much as you become excited when both monks and lay people, when they start to dabble a little bit in the Dhamma, now they get all excited. Now they want to start saying what they know. They want to start to give what they know to the world. Because people like to listen less and talk more, right? A lot of people are like that. I like to say what I have to say. So you have to listen. And as I said, thanks to technology, all you need to do is get yourself a microphone, get yourself an internet connection, grab a laptop, and you're talking to the entire world. My venerable friend Dhammajiva Hamdru, recently he gave a really good piece of advice to all of us. He said, when you give somebody some instruction, particularly when it's about the Dhamma, be very careful if you are fully sure about what it is you're saying. Do you know fully well that what you're saying is absolutely spot on? Because otherwise, you're gambling with their lives. You're gambling with their lives. Answer this question. This is a rhetoric question. Answer it in your own minds. How many of you, before you started to listen to the Dhamma, which reminded you that actually Nibbana is not something that's gone out of fashion, it's still there. How many of you thought that actually what we are supposed to do now is earn as much merit as we can, get into the heavens, and then just ride the wave until Maitri Buddha comes along? Rhetoric question. Answer it for yourselves in your own minds. Serious, pretty dangerous stuff. What guarantee do you have you're going to be here when Maitri Buddha is here? If you become a deva and you are born among devas who are wrong viewed, mithya dushtika, devas, then you're not going to receive the Dhamma at all. What do you become if you become an accomplice to the Mara? You know, he's in the Paranimitta Vasavarti. That's the best heaven that you can go to. There's no better heaven than that. So you do as much merit as you can, and then you are born in the realm of Vasavarti with Mara. It's Vasavarti, yeah, with Mara.
Now, you have the biggest mithyadrushtika association, wrong-viewed association that you can imagine. You could have hoped for. Now you're screwed. So you have to be very careful in talking about what you know, particularly when it comes to Dhamma, because it's not like politics. One election up, next one you can set it right. But not the path to Dhamma, not the path to Nibbana. If you mess this up, you're probably not going to get a second chance for a very long time. It's not even like education. It's not even like marriage. You mess it up, you can get a second chance. But not the path to Nibbana. If you mess this up, to get a second chance, it's going to take a very long time. Because, you know why? The main reason for that is people are very adamant. Because of mana, ego, people are not willing to change their view. People don't like to be proven wrong. They don't like it. I have my view and I hold on to my view. I'm not willing to budge. No matter what you say, I am right. Let's see if you are right or wrong. I am right. That is where we start. So people are like that. Don't fall victim to that. Okay? Once again I repeat, what I'm not suggesting is that you should always come here and listen to the Dhamma. That is not what I'm suggesting, not one tiny bit. Please choose the right teacher for you. But whichever teacher you choose, then follow their instruction until the end. Otherwise you're just going to keep jumping around and you're not going to get anywhere. Then you become like Tuccha Potila. Or Potila, who was called Tuccha. That's not something you want to be in a position to hear. Okay. So general advice. Just be careful. Because I think a lot of you, because you have now been listening to the Dhamma, have come to that point in your life where, or your progress in the Dhamma, where you have now become motivated explorers. Now you're pretty motivated. You want to attain Nibbana. That's really good. Kudos to you. Hats off. Right? You want to attain Nibbana. But to attain Nibbana, now you become pretty excited. And in your excitement, you can't contain yourself. So you want to do everything under the sun to attain Nibbana. So you go to every shop where they sell Nibbana. Sometimes you can become penny wise and pound foolish if you do that. Don't fall for short-term gains. Always make sure you know exactly what Nibbana is. Raga ke, dvesha ke, moha ke Nibbana. Nothing else is Nibbana. Flashes of light is not Nibbana. Being able to float on water or levitate is not Nibbana. Where does it say that is Nibbana? That's not Nibbana. For as long as you feel the fire of raga, dvesha, moha, desire, aversion and delusion burning from within, from your inside, that is, you are not at Nibbana. So you, whatever instruction you receive should be able to help you extinguish those fires. So we talk about ashwada, or pleasure, vexation, attachment, right? This is kind of the path that we talk about. This is the approach that we use. And I think recently someone asked me, the Buddha speaks of paticca-samuppada, and that is the path to Nibbana. So why is it you're talking about attachment, vexation, relief from vexation, pleasure? How is that even vaguely related to paticca-samuppada? Well, actually it's one and the same. Because what does paticca-samuppada talk about? Dependent origination. Dependent origination of what? What is the origination of? Dukkha. It's the origination of dukkha he talks about. Last week we talked about jati, remember? How if you form jati, then there is no turning back. From that point forward, it's all downhill. Right? So the Buddha speaks of the origination of dukkha, the origination of suffering. And he says the origination of suffering is dependent on causes. This is why he calls it dependent origination. Paticca samuppada. Eva metassa kevalassa dukkha khandassa samudayo hoti. That's how he ends his description of paticca samuppada. Avidya paccaya sankara, sankara paccaya vinyana, vinyana paccaya namarupa, namarupa paccaya salayatana, salayatana paccaya pasa, pasa paccaya vedana, vedana paccaya tanha, tanha paccaya upadana, upadana paccaya bhava, bhava paccaya jati, jati paccaya jara marana, shoka parideva, dukkha domanasa, eva metasa kevalasa, dukkha khandasa samudayo hoti. Monks, this is how suffering comes into being. So you can't stop it at jati and say, that's I know Parisamuppada. That is not what he gave that instruction for. It's kind of like the manual comes last. That's how usually you open the box, right? New device, new instrument. You try to figure it out yourself, right? And then finally, when you can't crack it, now you pick the manual up. Now you start reading it. If only you had read it, having put your ego to a side, if only you had read it when you first opened the box, you would have saved yourself a lot of time. Because the manual tells you exactly how to use that instrument, how to use that appliance. But no, you're not ready for that. Open the box, I'm going to have a go at it myself. You did exactly the same thing with dependent origination also. It came packed up nicely in a box, you opened it up, oh, dependent origination, something exciting, something interesting, now you start using it. Except you forgot to read the manual. The manual says, this is to teach you how suffering comes into being. Then you realize, that's what this is for. Until you realize what this is for, you're going to hold it this way around. Yes or no? The day you understand what this is for, now you're going to hold it the right way up. So for that, you just have to read the manual. Because it shows you with a schematic diagram, this is where you hold it. Until such time, you're going to hold it like this, and you're going to start hitting yourself. And you say, that hurts. Well, of course that hurts. You're doing it all wrong. That's not how you hold it. Hold it the other way around. Now start fanning yourself. Oh, that feels much better. All because you couldn't be asked to read the manual. The manual comes at the end. Eva metasa kevalasa dukkha khandasa samudayo hoti. Monks, this is how suffering comes into being. So it's for the purpose of analyzing how suffering comes into being that we have to use paticcasamuppada and nothing else. It's not to teach us anything else, although you can use it to study other things, like how the universe came into being. Whether there was a big bang or not, Paticcasamuppada can explain. Now don't ask me how. Because if that question came into mind, then the answer to that is vexation causes, or rather attachment causes, vexation. Because that is not what dependent origination is for. Is to teach you how suffering came into being. For as long as we are all suffering, there can't be a bigger problem than that for all of us. This is why I say, until you understand the Dhamma, every problem is going to be a vexation. Once you have understood the Dhamma, vexation is going to be your biggest problem. You just have to flip it on its head. Until then, every problem is a big vexation. When you understood the Dhamma, now vexation is the biggest problem. Then you're going to treat vexation, because that is what dependent origination is for, because that shows you, like, where did it all start? It started at jati. But what was the cause for jati? Bhava was the cause for jati. What was the cause for bhava? Upadana was the cause for bhava. What was the cause for upadana? Tanha, attachment. So we are already in the realms of tanha, ashwada, elim, right? We're already in the realms of talking about that. Because this is what we talk about, right? This is what Guru Hamru generally talks about. How it's because of avidya, ignorance, you attach yourself to something, and then as a result of attachment you start to vex, right? And then you start doing abhisankara, And then as a result of abhisankara, you are relieved from that vexation, which brings you pleasure. So jati is the pleasure. Jati is the pleasure. This pleasure, that a being that experiences pleasure, that is what has now become jati. But if you don't see that this is sufferable, you're going to look at this as being quite the prospect. You're going to look at this as being a blessing. This is why a new child is a... What is it? You tell me. What is a new child? A new boy? A new baby? Is a blessing, right? Yeah. A new arrival is a blessing. Until you understand that jati, whatever form it comes in, is not a blessing, but it's a curse in disguise. It's a curse in disguise. This is the start of your suffering. Because it's that ashwa that you're going to, because of the ashwa that you're going to attach yourself. It's because of pleasure you're going to attach yourself. So it shows you all the way back. If you tread Parijnampada backwards, it's going to take you to the cause. If you tread it forward, it's going to take you to the effect. So it's again cause and effect. So if you don't like the effect, then get rid of the causes. What are the causes? If you start going halfway through, you get to attachment. Because, so why do we only talk about ignorance and attachment? Why don't we spend a lot of time talking about salayat and nama rupa and vijnana? Why don't we spend a lot of time talking about these things? Why do we focus our talks on ignorance and attachment? Of you will know it by now, right? It's attachment which ultimately, and you know, we can relate that in our own lives. It's very easy to relate. You cried at the death of mother. Is that statement accurate? You cried at the death of mother? No. How do you rectify that? You cried at the death of my mother or your mother, right? So it's not I cried at the death of mother. I cried at the death of my mother. Mothers die all the time. None of us cry. Children die all the time. No one's crying. Houses fall down, break down all the time. No one's crying. Except for the person that owns it. Except for the person to whom it belongs. Now it becomes yours. That's tanha. So it's quite simple, really. When we look at our own lives, because, you know, ultimately, remember that the Buddha didn't come into this world to teach Paticchasamuppada as a lesson. His purpose was not to come and give you knowledge. His purpose is to come and show you that you're all suffering. That we're all suffering. Use Paticchasamuppada, use dependent origination, to redeem ourselves from suffering. And therefore, he gives the instruction in a way that we can all relate to. If I tell you, I am sad because the salayatana with which I took my mother passed, does that even make sense to anybody? No, but if I say because of my mother, already that all makes sense. Because it's how we interact with the world. We use words like my, mine, you, yours, through which we talk about possession. Right? These are words that we use to talk about possession. But all beings believe that possession is the path to happiness. The more you have, the happier you are, is what people believe in. The more money you have, the happier you are. The more children you have, the happier you are. The more husbands you have. Or is it the less husbands you have? No husbands you have. I didn't say that. So people believe the more they have, the happier that they can be. So having more is attaching to more. So the Buddha's purpose of coming to this world is to teach us, no, it's not happiness is more. Or it's Not more is happiness. Actually, less is happiness. The less you have, the happier you are. The less you're attached to, the happier you are. You know, something came to mind recently as I was just reflecting on the Dhamma. So I'm going to ask you a question, you answer it. This is all experiences from your own lives, okay? As a guy, he sees a girl for the first time in his life. As in, he's seen girls before, but this girl, he really likes the look of. So he has a crush. Okay? But he hasn't expressed his affection to this young lady yet. Now, if you put yourself into that situation, so gents, you can follow the story, ladies, flip it on its head. You have a crush towards a young man, okay? If you have a crush on somebody, if you like somebody, do you like for them to suffer? Simple question. If you like someone, do you like for them to suffer? No. Now you like this girl, okay? But you haven't expressed your liking to her yet. What is the cause for suffering? Attachment. Okay. Good. Let's proceed. Now you like this girl. If you like this girl, what's the next thing you ought to do? But she doesn't know about you yet. She doesn't know the first thing about you. It's just you have seen this girl, right? And it's love at first sight. Apparently things like that happen. Love at first sight, right? So you've seen this girl. Now you have an attraction to this girl. You have a crush. So what's the next thing that you're inclined to do? Well, you get to know her, right? You walk up to her. You express your affliction. Or you express your desire. You express to this girl that you like her. In the hope of what? In the hope of what? Getting her to like you. Okay. A moment ago you said, a moment ago you said that if you like her, you do not want her to suffer. Yes or no? Yes. Then you told me that you do know that attachment is the cause of suffering. You've just walked up to her, right? And you're saying things to her in the hope that she begins to like you. In other words, attach to you. Where is attachment going to lead her? Suffering. How dare you? And you said you like this person so much that you don't want them to suffer. But the very first thing you do to that person is get them to suffer on your behalf. Cruel or not, evil or not, ruthless or not. For someone who doesn't understand the Dhamma, they have an excuse. You don't. Sorry. Should I not have said that? Now, young girls in the audience, young lads in the audience, now you know that attachment is the cause of suffering. Now, if you walk up to somebody and start trying to charm them, in the hope that they attach them to you, that they attach to you, what you are doing is you are getting them to suffer. You are putting them in suffering. Do you really like that person? Do you really like that person? Do you really love that person? Because if you did, you wouldn't get them to suffer on your behalf. So once you've understood this Dhamma, you can't really get anyone to attach even to yourself.
because you know that attachment leads to suffering. So, parents, I would like to appeal to your intelligence, to your wisdom. If you speak to your children and say, "Putta, would you like pizza tonight?" What are you doing right now? You're causing them to attach to something. If they haven't ever had pizza in their lives, right, this is the first time you're talking to them about it. Now you're planting the seed of attachment in their minds. And the moment you plant it, now they're going to start suffering. So who caused them that suffering? The parents. It's a riddle, but it's the truth. It's the riddle that you find yourselves in all the time. So seriously, if you think about it, ladies and gentlemen, if you really like someone, if you really care about someone, put "like" to aside, if you really care about someone, you can't even come to think about getting them to attach themselves to anything, including yourself. So when someone says, "I like her, therefore I'm going to go and talk to her, I'm going to try to charm her, I'm going to cajole her to liking me in return," then that's not caring about her at all. So really, if you care about someone, let them be. If you really like somebody, let them be. One day they're going to attach to somebody else and suffer anyway, true, but why should that be on your behalf? So if you really like someone, then let them be. Otherwise you're a world-class hypocrite. Are you not? You know that attachment causes suffering, and what you're doing is getting the other person to suffer on your behalf. That's a world-class hypocrite. Sorry. Have I put you in a very difficult position? Because, you know, these young children, it's gonna come a time in life when, you know, you should give their hand in marriage. Right? So what are parents going to do then? Buddha, here. Look at all these pictures of young, beautiful ladies out there. Got it from the matrimonial section. What do you think? No, don't worry. When they grow up to that age, you won't have to do that. They'll have sorted themselves out by that time already. Yes. Think about these things. Because we don't think about things before we do them. Most of the time you just don't think. You just wait to suffer the consequences without thinking of the consequences beforehand. Ultimately, we put the very people we care about, we love so dearly, into suffering ourselves without even knowing about it. But like I said, now you have no excuse, because I have looked at all of you in the eye and explained this to you. So you have no excuse. So dua, when Ami one day comes and says, "Putta, it's time now, right?" Then now you can ask her. Do you not remember what Swami Nuhanse said that day in the sermon? "Do you not care about me at all, Ami?" You can ask her now. You're well within your rights to ask her. Otherwise, prove that I'm wrong. If you can prove me wrong, I'll happily rescind my statement. I'll take it back. Otherwise, you're willingly putting your child in that position. If you're happy with that, then so be it. It's okay, not my child. So, let's talk about anicca dukkha anatta, because this is what you have to be practicing when you come along for the meditation sessions. We have been discussing about this vexatious nature of Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. Because as living, breathing beings, sentient beings, there is no other way that we can really experience the world. Yes, we have our five senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue and a body. But these senses only bring the external world so far. It can't take it any beyond that. Our senses can only bring the external world as far as our brains. From that point forward, or at least, you know, as far as the outside of the body. Because after that it's all electrical impulses. That's all that goes to the brain, right? Electrical impulses. So at that point, the mind has nothing to do with electrical impulses. It cannot interpret that. So what the brain does is, on behalf of the mind, translate these encoded messages. It re-encodes them into Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana so that the mind can understand it. So really, no matter what you see around you, whether it's people, birds and bees and stars and moons and planets and whatever, the way that we know that they are there in the first place is because of Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana that arise and pass away in our mind. So recently I was having a chat with somebody and they really couldn't get this idea that to them they thought that the mind or the chitta, the sitta, okay, the chitta and Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana are one and the same. That's what they thought it was. So I was trying to explain to them, but they didn't get it until I gave them this analogy. So maybe it might help you as well. Imagine you're waiting for someone to arrive. So you're at the bus hold, waiting for a friend. You're waiting to pick your friend up from the bus hold. Okay, so you're waiting at the bus hold. So a bus approaches. You can see your friend waving from inside, so you know your friend is in the bus. Okay, so you're expecting the bus to stop and your friend to get off at the stop. But what happens is, this bus drives past. So can the friend get off if the bus drives past? No. So you ask the friend eventually, why did you not get off at the stop? Now the friend says, because the bus didn't stop. So if the bus didn't stop, whose fault is it? Imagine there's no bell that the friend could ring either. Okay? But the bus is supposed to stop at every stop, but the bus didn't stop at this stop. So whose fault is it? It's the bus's. Or the bus driver, whoever, whatever way you want to put it. Your friend was just a passenger in the bus. So the friend really did not have a choice about it. If the bus didn't stop at the stop, didn't come to a stop at the halt, then your friend couldn't get off the bus. You can't get off a moving bus. You're going to break a neck. So you have to wait for the bus to stop and then get off. Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana is like the friend in the bus. The only way this friend is going to be able to visit you is if he travels in the bus to get to you. And then he has to get off at the halt. But to get off at the halt, the bus has to stop there. But if this bus doesn't stop and it just passes you by, now your friend can't get off at that halt. So likewise, Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, the five through which, this set of five through which you understand the world, you experience the world, arises and passes away because it's traveling in the bus that is the chitta. It's the nature of the chitta, of the mind, to arise and pass away. It's because Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana are passengers in this bus that it is also subject to arising and passing away. Did you understand that? Let me repeat. Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana are passengers traveling in the bus which is the chitta. The nature of a chitta is to arise and pass away. So if the chitta arose and froze, then Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana will arise and freeze. But that's not how it works. The chitta arises and passes away. And because it passes away, now Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana has no choice, because it's traveling in the bus that is the chitta. So it has to arise with the citta and pass away with the citta.
So you see, the problem is not with Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. We are dealing with Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana as beings with a citta which arises and passes away. It's a very subtle point, but if you pay attention, you will get it. We are dealing with Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, the five aggregates. We are dealing with them with a mind that arises and passes away. Because we are dealing with them with a citta that arises and passes away, with a mind that arises and passes away, well, the five aggregates, they can't do anything else about it. They can't do anything about it. Because they're traveling in the bus that is the mind, arising and passing away. So the passenger can't get off and be with you because the bus has just driven past. So likewise, because the citta passes away, well, Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana can't do anything about it. It's going to pass away with it. You can't, there's nothing it can do about it. So it's not like Rupa has anything against you. Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, they don't have anything against you. It's not like it's their purpose to make you suffer. They have nothing against you. But the problem is, you and I, we have a mind which arises and passes away. And it's with a mind which has this feature, arising and passing away, we deal with Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. Because we are dealing with a mind that arises and passes away, and the mind is this arising and passing away is the only way that we can experience this, the five aggregates, well, it leaves us no choice. So if you want to deal with them, you have no choice but to let them arise and pass away. You have no choice about it. Otherwise, you have to find a mind which does not arise and pass away, or which can arise and then freeze for as long as you want it, then pass away when you fancy it. But none of us have a mind like that. Another example would be, let's say you have a visitor, you're expecting a visitor. So they're driving and their vehicle breaks down. Okay, halfway through the journey their vehicle breaks down. So what can they do about it? Why were you late? Car broke down. If they're saying the truth, okay, if the car's broken down, what can your friend have done about it? What can your visitor have done about it? Well, the car broke down. There's nothing I could have done about it. So the problem is that they're driving in a car that can potentially break down. So if you want to be guaranteed that your friend is going to arrive at exactly 2 p.m. on the day, exactly 2 p.m., the only way you can guarantee that is to give them a vehicle that is not going to break down. Otherwise, you have to accept that when the vehicle breaks down, they're going to be late. Yes? You have to accept that the child you bring into this world is going to be subject to illness. You have to accept that. If you don't like it, then don't make one. Because they come into this world with a body that can break down. So we have to accept that. Likewise, because we experience Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana through a mind whose nature it is to arise and pass away, therefore we say Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana are vexatious. That is why it's vexatious. It's not because they have anything against you. Because if you think that the problem is there, you're going to try to extinguish Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. You're going to try and rid Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. That is not the answer. Because the problem lays with us. It is with a mind that arises and passes away. We go to deal with them. So what can it do? You know, if you touch, you're cooking, right? There's a hot pan on the cooker. If you touch it without a glove, what's going to happen? It's going to burn your hand. Whose fault is it? Is it the pan? Is it the fire? No. You should have wore a glove to pick it up. So the fact that you're not wearing a glove is whose fault? It's my fault. It's our fault. Likewise, we are dealing with Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana, because all Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana are doing are just waiting for a chitta to arrive, and then they drop, and then off you go. Another one comes, drop, off you go. Another one comes, drop, off you go. So really, the mind is like a vehicle which transports Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. But yes, it's vexatious. You know, we say Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana rise and pass away. The reason for that is because they are traveling in this vehicle which is the mind, which is subject to arising and passing away. Now this, you have to make sense of this, otherwise meditation sessions are not going to work out. Because we have to understand that the problem is inside of us, not outside there. The problem is not with Rupa, not with Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. The reason that they are vexatious is because they are travelling in the bus, they are travelling in this vehicle which is the mind, which arises and passes away, so they have got no choice about it. They have to arise with the mind and pass away with the mind. But vexatious also because if you attach yourself to it, then you are left with no choice, because when it passes away, now something you like, something you love has just passed away. So whose fault is it? Whose fault is it? Rupa? Vedana? No. You can't change the fact that it's with the mind that you have to experience Rupa. You can't change that either. Because, you know, really, if we want to fix this problem, we must only be talking about the things that we can fix. Right? We can only talk about the problems, we can only talk about the things that we can fix. Can you fix the fact that you are dealing with Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vinyana? Can you change that? What else is there in the outside world? There is nothing else out there. You can only experience the world through the five aggregates. There is nothing else you can experience the world with. And to experience that, you only have the mind. So you have no choice there either. The nature of the mind is to arise and pass away. So you can't change that either. So the only thing you can change is attachment. Remember, you are not attached to the mind. It's not the mind you're attached to. It's not the bus you're attached to. It's the passenger in the bus. It's like when you're at the airport, right? Your son, your daughter, maybe someone you love. You know, at the airport, you wave them goodbye. Yes? And then what do? You go to the waiting lounge, or perhaps, you know, where you can see the flight. And then they say goodbye to the aeroplane in the sky. Goodbye. Have you ever done that? Those days people used to do like that. Not now, nowadays, but those days people used to do like that. Because nowadays, you know, traveling internationally is like going to the shop. But those days it was a big thing to travel abroad. So people used to go outside and wave at the flight. Are they really sad that the flight is passing away? What are they sad about? It's the passenger in the flight. But can they see the passenger in the flight? No, they can only wave at the flight. But they're not really sad that the flight is passing away, is flying away. It's because there's a passenger that you really love in the flight who's going away. That is why it makes you feel sad. And likewise, it's the chitta that arises and passes away. That is the vehicle in which Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana are the passengers. It's the passengers you are attached to. But because they are traveling in this vehicle which arises and passes away, you've got no choice. So with it, it arises, they arise, and with it, they pass away. But they are very distinct things. They're not one and the same. They're two very distinct things. Because remember, it's because of pleasure you attach to the world, right? Beautiful flower. What's the problem? Beautiful. Good, so you've been listening to the sermons. If you said flower was the problem, then we have a big problem. But beautiful flower, the problem is not with beautiful, is not with flower, the problem is with beautiful. Right? Why? How do we see beautiful? How do we see beautiful flower? Attachment to what? Is it the flower? Ultimately the mind can only experience what? Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana, right? So this is what the mind is attached to. And then the mind starts vexing. Not for the mind, not for the chitta, but for the Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. And then when it arises, now you are relieved of that vexation. And when it passes away, you are back in vexation. Not because the mind arises and passes away. It's because in this vehicle are traveling the passengers that you so dearly love. Did you have a question, sir? It is. Yeah. So it, and that is what vijnana does. Ultimately what vijnana does, it gives you the aggregate, it's the totality. It's the sum total of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara. Vijnana is the final decision maker. Gives you a decision of this is a beautiful flower. Because until then, you've seen flower, you've actually seen the rupa of the flower, then you've called it a flower, you know what things you can do with a flower, but ultimately, to then say, this is a beautiful flower that I can smell, that I can keep at home, all of that is the job of vijnana. So that is the sum total. That's where ultimately the decision is made. So the point being, it's these five that we are attached to, but they have no choice but to arise and pass away, because that's the only way we experience them, is with the mind. You can't change the way the mind works, because it arises and passes away, and therefore you can't change, you know, because for as long as your transport service is not changed, you can't get your workers, you can't expect them to come early. You can't expect them to be reliable, because your transport system is flawed. So your mind is the transport system. Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana simply use it as a mode of transport. But ultimately it's that five that you're attached to. So what's the problem with attaching to these five? Now if you should be able to understand that because we experience them with a mind that arises and passes away, we are really helpless. And it's more convincing when you see it in this way, that the problem is really inside. You know, we are talking about a problem with your mind. It's not a problem with rupa. It's the way that you experience them, and that is through a mind, which arises and passes away. Now you're helpless. If you wanted rupa to be with you for as long as you want it, then the only way you could do that is remove the mind and bring a new mind. A new type, a new model of mind, which stays for as long as you want it. Then rupa will also stay for that long. Then rupa will also stay for that long. And vedana, sanya, they'll also stay for as long as the mind will stay. Because they are simply passengers in the vehicle that is the mind that arises and passes away. So that we have to understand. So the more you begin to contemplate on this, the more you realize every time the problem is really, really, really deep-seated inside of me. There's nothing that I can do to fix this. The only thing that I can really do is rid myself of attachment. So if you see the Udayangama Attangama, which is the arising and passing away. So I'm going to talk about Udayangama Attangama, Ashwada and so on, right? Because that is what we need to contemplate on Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. This arising and passing away, when you begin to see that this happens in the mind, and it's ultimately Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, which is arising and passing away, now you know that there's nothing you can do except for ridding yourself of attachment. Now that shouldn't be because I say so. This should really make absolute perfect sense to all of you. If you want to come along to the meditation sessions, it has to make sense to you, it has to be obvious to you that the only solution to this problem is ridding yourself of attachment, and there is no other solution whatsoever. That has to be crystal clear to you, laser sharp, crystal clear to you, that ridding yourself of attachment is the only solution to the problem. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. If you haven't gotten that, if the penny hasn't dropped there, you're wasting your time. Ridding yourself of attachment is the only way you can fix this. Why? The only way we can deal with the betel leaf is how? Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. Why is that so? Because my senses can only bring sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, and they can only come as far as the outside body, right? The extremities. And then from that point forward is simply electrical impulses. I mean, like we're talking through the process. Okay? From that point forward, it's simply electrical impulses. It hits the brain, and then from the brain to the mind, it's simply rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana. It doesn't matter where it came from, doesn't matter what came, how it came. Ultimately, it's simply rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana that the mind is dealing with. That's it, nothing else. But these packets of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana, they're being dropped into a mind which arises and passes away. You can't change the fact that it's electrical impulses. Even if you could, you can't change the fact that it's rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana that your mind can interpret. Because, you know, one day you might decide, actually, I'm not interested in rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana. I want something else. There's nothing you can do. It's either rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana or nothing. That's it. You have no other choice. If you want to experience the world, then rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana is the only thing that your mind can interpret. And the only way you can interpret this is by taking these blocks of rupa. It's like data falling into these packets. If any of you have done any networking, you'll know this. This falling into packets that transfer data back and forth, right? So bits of information falling into these packets. And those packets arise and pass away. Or they fall into this process, this chitta that arises and passes away, which is intrinsic. You can't change that nature. It's the way of the mind arising and passing away. And that being the case, the only thing you can change then is attachment. That is the only thing you can really change. Nothing else you can change. And that's good. It's good that is the only thing you need to change. Might as well be the case. Because what if it was the betel leaf that caused you suffering? Be my guest. There's lots of it here. What if it was rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana that caused you suffering? Yeah. Then you can never become an arahant. Because what happens in the mind of an arahant? It's still rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana. What about the nature of the mind of an arahant? It arises and passes away. So an arahant has not stopped the mind from arising and passing away. He or she has not stopped rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana from coming in. He has not changed the outside world. The only thing that he has changed is not attaching. Isn't that great that that's all you have to do? Just stop attachment? It's also the hardest thing to do. But it's the only thing you need to do. The only thing you need to do is the hardest thing to do. But there's no other choice. So if there's no other choice, then you might as well get to work at it. There's no other choice. That's why the Buddha says, the second noble truth of suffering is what? Or the second noble truth of the cause of suffering is what? Attachment. Nothing else. He didn't say attachment and XYZ. No, there was no room for any doubt. Dukkha samudaya are satya. What? Tanha. There's no tanha and something else, or little bit of that and little bit of this. No. Very clear. So clear. Nothing more clear. Attachment is the cause of all suffering. Because that's the only factor that you can really change. You can't change, you can't influence any of the other factors. Remember the equation I once gave you for suffering? There was an equation I drew out on a whiteboard. For those of you who were here, will have seen it. Anicca world times by attachment equals suffering. So there are three ways you can rid yourself of suffering. One, change anicca world to a nicca world. Is that even feasible? Then there's no point talking about it. That's why the Buddha didn't talk about anicca being the cause of suffering. You know, he speaks anicca dukkha anatta. But then you ask him, what is the cause of suffering? He could have said anicca. The world is not to my liking is the cause of suffering. False. I think before the meditation program, I'll give you all a test paper. True and false. Should I ask you some questions? I'm doing this now with our senior monks. Because in our meditation programs, as those of you who have come along will know, I think the first two programs, you missed it. From that point forward, we have started doing them. Individually, we sit down with you and talk to you. And we ask you to explain to us the Dhamma. So it will be something like, I'll play a role, I'll come to you and say, this is a really pretty girl, I'm so attached to her. Okay, but my mother doesn't let me keep my relationship. How do I convince my mother to let me be in that relationship? So I've just thrown at you a googly. Because it's the problem with the mother. Is the problem with the mother? No, but most people start there. Well, you know, this is how you should talk to your mother. Help her to understand that, you know, she's not such a bad girl after all. That is not the answer I'm looking for. But the only reason I threw it was to trip you, and you fell. If you really understand the Dhamma, you will say, okay, so you think your mother is the problem. But that is not really the problem. The problem is your attachment to the girl. That is where you should always come back. You should home back to attachment. Because if you can do that, and if you know every single time that attachment is the cause of suffering, no matter what obstacle, what challenge I throw at you, you will always keep coming back there. Attachment is the cause of suffering. That is how you will know you have understood the Dhamma. But you can't just say it by memorizing it. You have to be able to apply it in your own lives. Someone says something and you feel bad. You feel angry. What does your mind say instinctively? If it says, beat the hell out of that guy, you haven't understood the Dhamma. Inside your mind, instinctively it should come the answer, attachment is the cause of suffering. Whose attachment? His? No, my attachment. Both affection and affliction are states of suffering. Both caused by attachment. One is raga, the other is dvesha. Raga is where something you want has materialized. Dvesha is where it hasn't materialized. So there is no more potential to materialize. All opportunities are now gone and it cannot materialize. Moha is where you're waiting for it to materialize. It's that middle state, waiting, waiting, waiting. It's like loading. You know, the computer says loading. That's the state of upeksha, moha. And then you load, 99% crash. That's dvesha. And then 100% loaded. Now, raga. Raga, dvesha, moha. But regardless of which end result you go to, they will all arise and pass away. So raga, something has manifested to your liking, is that not going to pass away? Because when you say it's to your liking, what are you really saying? This rupa, this vedana, this sanya, this sankara and this vijnana are to my liking. Are you saying anything else other than that? Do you mean anything else other than that? No, you say I like that girl, what do you really mean? I like the rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana which has arisen in my mind. That's what I really like, not you. What's inside of me is what I like. But that's going to pass away. And then it's going to put you back into vexation. And then dvesha. This is a two-pronged attack. One, because what has loaded is not what you like. And the second prong is what you wanted has not loaded. So an example that Guru Swami Nuance regularly gives in sermons is, you're at home, you say, Puta, come here, you call your son. Say, Puta, come here. So you wait for your son to come. The door is ajar, and you see the dog walking in. Now two problems. One, it's not your son. You didn't ask your son from last birth to come. So it's not your son. So the and number two, the dog has walked in. So now you have to get the dog to get back out, and you still have to get your son to come back in. So it's a two-pronged affliction. It's a two-pronged attack. Whereas with raga, it's what you have attached to is going to pass away with your mind. Because again, it's ultimately rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana. Even with dvesha, it's still rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana. With moha, still it's the same. Remember, the mind cannot experience anything other than the five aggregates. That's why the Buddha says, rupam bhikkave anicca, yadanicchan tan dukkam. Not chittam bhikkave anicca. He didn't say the problem, you know, what you are attached to is not the chitta rising and passing away. You are attached to the rupa, but that rupa comes in the chitta. You keep checking flight arrivals on the arrivals board. Why? Because you are so keen on the flight arriving? No, you are waiting for the passenger in the flight. That's why. It's your friend or your loved one who's coming in the flight, that's who you're attached to. But you don't have a board which has all the names of everyone on the flight and what time they're arriving. What you have is the name of the airline, of the flight or the flight number, whatever. That's what is on display. But it's you're checking the flight time, but really what you're checking is what time is my friend going to arrive. That's what you're really checking. Because they're going to be coming in the flight. So rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana, they're going to be coming in the flight, in the bus, in the car, whatever you want to put it, of this chitta which arises and passes away. So vexatious, because if you attach yourself to it, when it passes away, now you're going to be left in a state of vexation. Because rupa passes away, leaving behind attachment. Vedana passes away, leaving behind attachment. Sanya, sankara, vijnana passes away, leaving behind attachment. Now you are still attached, but you have lost the very thing that you are attached to. How does that make you feel? If you lost the object and attachment at the same time, would there be a problem? Would there be a problem? No. Father dies, and you are no longer attached to him also. No problem. But father dies, leaving attachment. You still want your father to be with you. You want your mother to be with you. You want your loved one to be with you. That is why, you know, again, put into your life examples, and this will make really, really good sense. Right? A guy with a girl, after a while, he's no longer interested in the girl. Now he wants to find a way to get this girl, to give this girl the boot. But he doesn't want to make her feel bad. So he doesn't want to upset her. So he's just waiting for the opportunity, for the right time where the girl comes and says, I'm not really interested anymore. So when the girl says, you know, I think it's time, I think, you know, we're not working out. You know, it's not working out between us. The guy will say, okay, if you think so. Oh well, you know, everything that arises passes away. Now he has no problem. Why? The girl's going away and the attachment is not there either. But if any of you have ever shed a tear because you got given the boot, that was because girl left, boy left, leaving behind attachment. That's why you cried. That's why you wept. What you ought to be doing is, when they say, I'm going to be breaking up with you, can you take my attachment with you? Then he'll be fine. But you can't do that. They're going to go away, leaving attachment behind. Why? Because attachment happens where? In my mind. Again, that's a good point to prove that what you are attached to is really not the outside object. You are attached to rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana. They left, leaving behind the upadana, rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana, that's still in your mind. The clinging aggregates, the rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana, which you still yearn Because ultimately, with every citta that arises, this is how you find happiness. You're always doing a comparison. You're doing a comparison. This is what I want. This is what I'm getting. Now what's the result? If it's exactly what you asked for, then you feel happy. If it's not what you asked for, then that's sadness. If you still don't know, still checking, then that is upeksha. Sapaduka upeksha. Tiso vedana. Sapaduka upeksha. So equanimity, the equanimity that... There are two types of equanimity. One is the equanimity that is experienced by arahants, which is upeksha tara upeksha, which is not a state of vexation. That is why the Buddha says, look at ashwad as a dukkha, sapa dukkha lesa. Look at dukkha as a stake, or perhaps let's say a prong or a trident. You know what a trident is? Trishule. But imagine this is one of it. Dukkha hulak lesa. It's like a ula. And upekshav anicca lesa. Look at upeksha as being anicca. Why anicca? Because it's vexatious. Pilanatto anicchatto. Meaning of anicca is pelanasulu. Vexatious. That is the nature of anicca. Sapa, dukkha, upeksha, they both ultimately leads you to suffering. This type of sapa, dukkha, upeksha. Good feeling, bad feeling, and equanimous feeling. Ultimately, none of these three will bring you any suffering, any happiness. The only state of happiness that you can really look forward to is that of upeksha tara upeksha, which is unconditional equanimity. That is unconditional. It's not based on conditions. So that is what we should aim for. And the only way to rid ourselves of attachment then is if we rid ourselves of ignorance. So ignorance is what? Beautiful flower. Where's ignorance? Beautiful. Not flower. Ignorance is with beautiful. Remember, a couple of weeks ago I explained to you, if it is really out there, then we should have invented an instrument by now to measure it. Is there an instrument to measure beauty? None has been invented yet. But that doesn't stop us all from having one for ourselves. That's why you look at a bunch of flowers and say, that's beautiful. So you have an instrument with you. But there is no instrument in the outside world. And that is why beauty lies in the mind of the beholder. They say eyes of the beholder, I say mind of the beholder. Or rather the Buddha says mind of the beholder. So, if beauty lies in the mind of the beholder, then that's the only way, that's the only place where beauty can be judged. There's no instrument out there that can judge beauty. It's only the mind that can judge it. So that tells us then that beauty is a subjective thing. It's not objective, it's subjective. So what does subjective mean? It's different, based to each of us. Each of us will have a different view, a different opinion. What you find beautiful, madam, is not what I'm going to find beautiful. What you find beautiful, doer, is not what you find beautiful, sir. That's why it's subjective. So if each of us have a different response to the question, do you find this beautiful? If each of you have a different response to it, then that must tell us something about the object that I'm holding. Beauty cannot be in the object. But if I asked you all, how heavy is this? You're all going to give me the same answer. You're going to say, let us get ourselves a weighing scale, put it on the weighing scale, and then you're all going to come and give us the same answer. Give or take maybe a few milligrams. Right? But if I ask you, is this beautiful? You're not going to come and say, yes, give or take a few milligrams. it's going to be completely opposite answers. One's going to say yes, the other's going to say no. That's binary. It's not yes or 0.5 of a yes. It's not you're going to say yes or you're going to say no. Binary. Yes, but yes. Yes, but no. Yes, but. Oh, no, but. So that's when you're trying to say yes, but you're trying to find other responses to maybe make the other person happy. You know, like, dare I say, ladies, when you dress yourself up, right, when you've done the best you can in front of the mirror, you go and ask your husband, you go and ask your partners, what do you think? That's the worst question you can ask a married man. Because no matter what answer you give, it's the wrong answer. If you're a married man, you will have this experience. No matter what answer you give, it's always the wrong answer. So you try and avoid those questions as much as you possibly can. So you have to say yes but, or no but. So because first you say yes and then you gauge what is the facial expression. Or you say no and then you gauge the facial expression. But you use the word but so you can then quickly recover yourself from that situation you've gotten yourself into. Why? Because ultimately, the person who's asking the question have a particular five that they're interested in. There's a particular Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana that they want to hear from you. Otherwise they won't ask you the question. If you don't want an answer, would you ask a question? You don't want the answer, would you ask the question? No. You're asking the question because you want the answer. When you say you want the answer, you already have an answer inside. What you want to check is if the answer that's coming from the other side matches with my answer. Otherwise, you wouldn't ask the question. So when you ask, do I look pretty? You already have an answer to that question. Sometimes ladies are very unkind. They deliberately leave something that doesn't fit and then still ask the question just to check, are you being genuine? Maybe a flock of hair that's a bit too long compared to the others. What do you think? Oh, really nice. You're just saying that. What about that hair? You didn't mention it. So you're just saying it. You just made it up. There's no way out. There's no right answer to this. There's no wrong answer to this. Because ultimately, they already have an answer. If you are able to read their mind, now you can give the right answer. Because they already have an expectation of, this is what I'm hoping to hear. Now, you have to give them that answer. It works both ways. Gents, you know, no different. I just used an example that I was familiar with. It's no different, right? So, ultimately, what we need to understand is, it's because of ignorance that we always attach to things. And ignorance is ultimately seeing this world as being beautiful. So, the question is, right, when you start to make your meditation sessions, what will you have to think about? What will you have to reflect on? What do you have to contemplate on? This is why I always say, forget about the stuff that you find painful. That's not the things we need to focus on. Because none of us attach to pain. None of us attach to suffering. That's not what we need to focus on. Attachment is the moment you say beautiful flower, that's when you attach to the flower. Expecting beauty, you attach to the flower. But beauty was never in the flower. So therefore you're going to be disappointed. You expected beauty, but attached to the flower. You expected beauty, you attached to beauty. Now, you expected beauty and you brought home beauty. Now, that's okay. But you can't bring home beauty because it doesn't exist. If you go to the florist, what is the only thing you can bring home? Flowers. But why did you bring them home? Beautiful. So really, what did you want to bring home? Beautiful. You didn't want to bring home flowers. You wanted to bring home beautiful. But can you bring home beautiful? No, you can only pick and hold and touch flowers. So you bring home flowers expecting beauty to come along with it. But beauty is not in the flower. So you paid your hard-earned money to buy flowers when actually what you wanted was beauty. But beauty is not in the flower. So you brought home the wrong thing. Because beauty was always in your mind, not in the flower. So you just wasted your money, frankly. Did you not just waste your money? This is why the more you're ignorant, the harder you're going to have to work. Because the more you're going to have to earn. Why? So the more you can go and buy beautiful things. The more you can go and buy delicious food. The more you can go on luxurious breaks, holidays. You're going to have to earn a lot of money for that. Because your mind is constantly spurning out these falsehoods, these fallacies, these mirages. This throwing out all these fantasies that the mind has created within itself, and it now expects you to go and find it in the outside world. But beauty does not exist out there. I met one guy recently. His goal is to travel the world, and he's counting how many countries he's been to. So he likes to go on holiday. He goes to travels east, right? Far east, Singapore, Malaysia, countries like that, Thailand. And so I ask him the question, so you go there once a year, sir? Yes. No, madam, do you go there once a year? Yes. Where do you think people in that country go on holiday? Because if that country you're visiting is the number one destination for tourists, because it's the most beautiful country there is, then where should those people be spending their holiday? In that country. But where do Singaporeans go on holiday? To Singapore? No. They go west. West goes east and east goes west. Why so? Because beauty they don't see in what they have. Because they've seen it every day seen it, and then after that, it's no longer beautiful. Then they realize that it's no longer beautiful. But that's not a realization that comes through the understanding of the Dhamma. It's why do you no longer see beauty? If you see it always? How? What does that mean? What is getting used to it? Put it into the in context of the Dhamma. This is proof, ladies and gentlemen. This is proof that pleasure is relief from vexation. Solid proof. The fact that you keep seeing something. I think someone asked a question a while ago. Why do you eat cake? And then after a while, you just don't like that cake anymore. You want to do something else. Why? This is proof that pleasure is in relief from vexation. How so? Because when you get to experience it all the time, you're no longer vexing for it. Because you're no longer vexing for it, you're not going to find pleasure in it. That is why. Is that not solid proof? That pleasure is in relief from vexation? So, if you find a girl attractive, what's the last thing you ought to do? See her every day. And how do people see the other person every day? Absolutely. If you find a girl attractive, if you think she's beautiful, Buddha, the last thing you should do is get married to her. Take the young lass home. A few months into that relationship, you're seeing her every time you want to now. Whenever you're vexing, you are able to relieve yourself from vexation. And then what happens? You stop seeing beauty. If beauty was in the lady, in the girl, you would have seen that beauty every day. Solid proof, is that not? That pleasure is in nothing other than relief from vexation. Isn't that the pleasure that you so yearn to bring into your lives? You work so hard and toil and labor
day and night to bring to your lives this pleasure, which is nothing other than the mind itself attaching to something, then vexing for it, and then relieving itself from vexation. It's completely an internal process. You know, sometimes some devotees, they bring alms to the monastery, right? I think the other day Guru Hamdra was talking about cashews. Right? So people love to give cashew when they give alms to monks in monasteries and things like that. Why is that? Because they like it. But they don't realize that every man and his dog who comes to the monastery feeds us cashews. Now what happens? Every lunch it's cashew. Now, what was once a delightful item becomes so distasteful, at the sight of it you start to puke. The sight of it is disgusting after a while. I'm not saying that is how it is. I'm just saying, this is how our minds work. Is it cashews again? Oh, not again. But to you who gives the food, to you it's so delicious. It's a delightful meal that you've just given. Why? Because you find it so delightful, so delicious. Because you don't eat it every day. That's why. So what you give on alms are the things that you like to eat. Yes or no? Yes. Thankfully we don't have cows giving us alms. If ever they decide to give us alms, what are we going to have to eat? This is how people's minds work. So, you know, this is solid proof that something you find pleasurable or pleasure is completely a subjective thing. It's never found in the object. It's never in the outside world. And for it to be a subjective thing, it has to be something that happens in the mind. So you attach yourself to something, now you start vexing, and as soon as you receive it, now you are relieved from vexation. It's not the object that brought you that pleasure. You can now stop searching for it. The search has ended. When was Nemo's family happy? Nemo? When were they happy? When they found Nemo. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, some of you will. Go and watch Finding Nemo. So Nemo's a little fish who was caught by a fisherman and got taken and put into a fish tank. And then Nemo's family starts looking for Nemo. But Nemo was always there with the rest of his family, and they didn't particularly find his association, his companionship, that all that pleasurable. But one day, this guy gets fished, put into a tank, and now everyone in the family wants to try and retrieve Nemo. So that's why it's called Finding Nemo. There was an old cartoon movie, I just remembered. Because when you found it, you can now stop looking. Looking is such a vexatious process, it's very frustrating. No one likes to look for something they've lost. People don't like looking. People don't like searching. But they like finding what they're looking for. Otherwise, you wouldn't use Google. You'd go and look for it yourself. If you found searching all that exciting, you wouldn't use your Google for it. You wouldn't use a tool for it. You just go looking for it. You would go into the libraries. Do you like going to libraries, turning all the books in all the pages, looking for information? No, now, because thanks to technology, you can just type it into Google and Google gives you all the answers. Why? Because you don't like searching. People don't like research. Why? Because it's so vexing. So time consuming. When is time consuming ever a problem?
When you are watching your favorite movie, is time consuming a problem?
No.
When you are with friends, when you are in companionship that you really like, do you find it time consuming? No, you don't complain about it. So consumption of time is never a problem when you are doing something you like to do. So then why have people invented search engines? It's because they don't like searching for things. They don't like looking for things, but they like finding the answers. Why? Because that's the only time you can relieve yourself of vexation. The vexation for the vexation that was relieved because you have found what you were attached to, what you were looking for. So contemplate on that. So this is why I say, it's not the suffering with that we need to worry about. Put suffering to a side. Anytime you find something pleasurable in your lives, this is a moment, this is a precious moment to contemplate. Sometimes our young monks tell me that from time to time they are reminded about home. Right? So it's a natural thing to expect. Because it's only once you know, it's through your practice of the Dhamma that those thoughts don't really bother you anymore. Okay? So there are times I'm reminded about home. So sometimes when I sit down for meditation, I'm reminded of all the things I used to do as a lay person. Sometimes with my wife, with my parents, with my brother, right? The things I used to do. But that, when I remind myself, I sniggle. It makes me laugh. Not because I'm vexing to experience those situations again. Because I let out a sniggle because it makes me feel what a time waster I was. All those things I used to do, thinking that they were going to make me happy. What a waste of time that was. So when our young monks tell me, Swami knows, I'm thinking, you know, these memories come back to me. Flashes of memories. Girlfriends I used to have. Not all at the same time. Okay, outgoings that I used to have with my family, trips we used to go on, holidays we used to go on, the restaurants we used to go and eat at. Right? When these memories come to mind, what am I supposed to do? They ask me. And they say sometimes I try to change my focus on something else. I try to focus on the meditation object and not think about those things. I say, no, that's not what you should be doing. You're going about it completely the wrong way. Because the karmasthan is nothing other than This is like the bar of soap. To offer you an analogy. It's a bar of soap. The karmasthana is a bar of soap. What good is a bar of soap if you can't find dirty linen? What good is it? If you don't have dirty linen, what good is a bar of soap? No use, right? No use. So if you don't have dirty linen, you don't need a bar of soap. If you have dirty linen and you don't have a bar of soap, then that is also not a situation you want to find yourself in. But once you have a bar of soap, now, if cleaning up your mess or getting your dirt cleaned up is your concern, now you're going to be happy that you can dig up all the dirty linen from your cupboards. Because that's your objective. I want to clean all my clothes and wash them, clean them, right? I want a fresh laundry. I want to get my laundry done. And if you don't have a bar of soap, now it's a problem. So you just keep piling it up until you go and get soap. You know, you might have examples of that. Sometimes you run out of washing powder. Now what do? You just keep it piling up until you go and buy washing powder. But after you've found your washing powder, now if your objective is to wash all your linen, then you're happy to find all the linen that is in your cupboards, in your drawers, or wherever it might be. So the Dhamma or the Karmasthana is your bar of soap. The things that you're attached to, this is your dirty linen. So when you do meditation, bhavana, what you do is you take your dirty cloth, now you rub it, you wash it with the soap. You wash it until what? Until it's clean. Until all the dirt has come off. Until all the grime and the dust and all that has come off. Then you move on to the next item of clothing. Then you wash that. Put that away. Then you move on to the next item of clothing. So all these memories that come back, What are they? Dirty items of clothing, dirty items of linen that keep coming back. So you should be glad that you are finding all these dirty linen, because now you have a bar of soap, so you can wash them. What is your objective? To wash, to use up all the soap, or to wash up all your dirty linen? Which one's your objective? Wash up your dirty linen. So aren't you glad that you can find all the dirty linen? You ought to be glad that you can find all of it, because now you can wash it all. If you couldn't find it, if you had to struggle to find it, now you have a problem. Sir? Beg your pardon? Exactly. The dirt in the linen, that is your attachment. So when you wash with the bar of soap, what do you get rid of? The linen or the dirt? The dirt. You don't wash away the cloth. You keep the cloth, you wash the dirt away. Right? So that is the purpose of using this bar of soap. Not keep the dirt and wash the linen away. You keep the linen and wash the dirt away. That's what you do. So you do it until all your linen has been washed. So this is what we do when we do karmasthan, when we meditate. So now, if your objective is to clean up all your laundry, is to wash all your laundry, then you can only be satisfied fully once all the laundry has been washed up. Until then, there's no time to rest. There's no time to rest. You know the old expression, there's no rest for the wicked. You heard that? There's no rest for the wicked. True. Someone who is wicked is someone who has raga, dvesha and moha. So there can't be any rest for someone who is wicked. There can't be. Because they still have defilements that have to be washed away with the bar of soap that is the Dhamma. So your karmasthana is going to be the Dhamma. So when we practice our meditation, I'll be giving you the karmasthana. So it will be anicca dukkha anatta or some variant of it. So in the talk that I'm going to give you before we start the meditation session, I'll be talking to you about the application of anicca dukkha anatta. But I'll give you some examples. But those are examples that are going to be very personal for each of you. So I don't know your lives like I do mine. And I don't know your lives like you do yours. So only you know the things that you're attached to. And the easiest way to find the things you're attached to is just really close your eyes. So simple. What's going to happen? Yeah, everything starts coming. Because now there are no inputs coming from your eyes. So as soon as your eyes have been shut, and if there's no sound coming from the background either, because you know we try and meditate in a quiet environment, right? Then the only faculties that are now currently bringing you is impulses. Your tongue is really, it's used to the saliva, taste of saliva in your mouth, so it's not really going to be stimulated. And then all that's left is your breathing maybe, which again you're used to now. Sitting down somewhere, again you're used to it. So really now your mind is looking for something new. Something interesting, something exciting. So the mind is now going to start wandering. As I say, all you have to do is shut your eyes. If you have the soap, now you just have to wait. It's like if you're hunting deer, and if you have the bow and arrow, you just have to wait for the deer to come in front of you. You don't have to go looking for deer. Deer will come to you. All you have to do is be ready with your bow and arrow. As soon as you see deer, let go. Literally, let go. And metaphorically, let go. How do you let go? You have to contemplate. I'm experiencing ashwada, I'm experiencing pleasure. Now's the time to contemplate on that. How is it that I experience pleasure? We know now that pleasure is nothing other than relief from vexation. And that is why I say, it cannot be because I say so. I can't emphasize this enough. Okay? You can't be telling me that pleasure is relief from vexation because Guru Hamdro says so. Or I say so. Or Budhu Hamdro says so. That will not work. It will not work like that. It has to make sense to you. You have to be able to explain it. So, you know what I suggest? Something that we do during the 5-day meditation programs is, like I said, our monks will sit down with one of our candidates, and we sit down and we go through it, the discussion. Explain to me I'm attached to the girl, now help me. Try that out at home. You know, particularly if you come here as a family, then you're going to find it a lot easier because they, you know, you both have an understanding of the Dhamma. So you can correct the other person if they get it wrong. But even otherwise, you know, if you can find someone to talk to, get them to sit down in front of you and tell them to ask you to apply the Dhamma that you know into a real life example. For example, you might go, when I smell paripu, when I smell dal, my mouth starts salivating. Right? And I really want to eat it. I can't walk past a dish of dal curry without going and dipping a spoon into it or having a taste of it. But my mother doesn't like me doing that. Okay, leave that complication to aside for a moment. Help me. Help me rid myself of this attachment that I have to the dal curry. Now, you get the other person. So the other person has just asked you the question. Now it's your turn to explain the Dhamma. And you have to start from the very basics. The person who's asked you the question must pretend that they have no understanding of the Dhamma. So you're going to say, well, when we... let's talk through that example. Okay? So you are attached to paripu. What should you do? The only way that you can experience paripu, the only way you can experience dal curry is through eyes, ears, nose, tongue and body. These are the only five senses through which we can sense the outside world. So we see a sight. Dal curry is probably not going to have a sound, but you're going to have a smell, a taste and of course touch. So through these four senses you're going to experience dal curry. But these four senses can only bring you sight, smell, taste and touch as far as your brain. The mind cannot perceive sight, smell, taste or touch. The mind can only perceive these things called Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. And at that point the other person has to go, Rupa what? Because now you have to explain what Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana is. So you say, Rupa is like a photograph. It's not the same thing, it's not that either. It's like a photograph of a person. It's not the person, it's neither not the person. It's a photograph. It's an impression. It's an impression of the thing that you have seen, impression of the thing that you have smelled or tasted or felt. Right? It's not the actual object, it's the impression. Then Vedana. Your mind knows that now it has seen something. It's like an alarm bell going off. I have just seen something. I have just smelled something. I have just tasted something. So that's Vedana. Sanya is the label that you give to that impression that you just received. That is the sight of paripu or dal curry. This is the smell of dal curry. This is the taste of dal curry. This is how dal curry feels. Either to my tongue or in my mouth or you know with your hands if you mix your food, whatever. So it's only through these five senses you can experience dal curry, but Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, then Sankara. So when I say dal curry, what's the verb that comes to mind? Take a bath? No, eat. That's the verb that comes to mind. It's the doing thing. With whatever Rupa that has come into your mind, it's the doing thing, it's the verb that is associated with that object. That is Sankara. And then finally Vijnana. So this is a lovely dal curry. How is it lovely? Because? Attachment. Because there was a comparison that happened. Remember the comparison that happened? Right? So Rupa, being the either Rupa, Gandha Rupa, Rasa Rupa or Sparsha Rupa. Then Vedana. Okay, Sapaduk Upeksha Vedana. Sanya, the label that you gave it. Sankara, the verb that is associated with dal curry. And Vijnana, finally the combination of all those together and you say, this is dal curry that I can eat. So it's when you put all of those into one sentence. It's something like that. It's when you put all of those things into one sentence. This is yellow. This is round. Okay, has this smell, has this taste, has this touch, and it's nice, and you can eat it. When you put all of those into one sentence, now you have Vijnana. So that is the packet of information related to Dalkari. So that is how your mind was able to understand Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara, understand Dalkari quite simply. But these packets of information came into a mind that arises and passes away. Remember, you have to talk about the mind arising and passing away. Otherwise, this hasn't clicked yet. Because that is where we really realize that there is no hope. Hopeless. Because we are cursed with a mind that arises and passes away. And you can't control the arising or passing away of the mind. So wherever Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana comes from, these packets are going to drop into a mind which arises and passes away. It's like the bus, like the flight, like the car. Arises and passes away. It's going to come and drive past. It's going to arrive and it's still going to drive past. So it's not going to stop when you want it to stop. It didn't come past because you wanted it to come past. It just came. And when it came, it had passengers within it. Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. So when the mind arises and passes away, now it's vexatious. Why is it vexatious? Because if you attach, when it passes away, you're going to be left with suffering. Because what has passed away is something that you like, something that you love. Therefore it's vexatious. So that is anicca. So anvita udayangama attangama. And ashwada. Pleasure. This is what's really going on, arising and passing away, okay, in the example of Paripu. But I found it pleasurable. How is that so? The way that I found, how I found it pleasurable was, when it passed away, when the mind passed away, the Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana to do with Paripu also passed away. Now the mind is again left in a state of vexation because it passed away leaving attachment behind. It didn't pass away with attachment. Attachment was left behind, Rupa passed away. Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana passed away, leaving behind attachment. So now that has left me with a state of... It's like, you know, imagine if you had... If you wanted the plumber to come and do some work at home, okay? Halfway through the job, the plumber goes. Job is left undone. Now, how do you feel? That's a state of vexation. The plumber's gone, but you are still left with the attachment for the plumber because the job is still left undone. Once the job is complete, now it's okay if the plumber goes or stays. It really doesn't matter. Well, actually, you'd prefer them to go anyway. But now the job is done. But for as long as the job is left undone, if the plumber goes, if the worker goes, now you have a problem. Likewise, attachment is left. But Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, they've gone. Oh, the attachment is left behind. Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, they've left. One's left behind, the other has left. So now we have a problem. So when you're in that state of vexation, again, another packet of Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana comes from the outside world. At that point, this mind was in a state of vexation, waiting for what it loves to come back. So it was searching. And as soon as that packet of five came along, the five aggregates came along, now you no longer have to search for it because you just received it. When that searching comes to an end, when that void has been filled, when that gaping hole has now been filled, now you feel a sense of relief. And that experience is the experience of pleasure. But unfortunately, at the same time, you also received that packet of five. Because they happened at the same time, they coincidental. It was coincidental that Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana coming, arriving, and relief from vexation, they happened at the same time. Because they happened at the same time, what ignorance tells us is it's Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana that brought us pleasure. But that is not what really happens. So you see, Udayangama Attangama and Ashwada. Until you see Udayangama Attangama, which is the arising and passing away, until you really understand it, we believe that pleasure comes from the outside world. That is why this connection you have to be able to see. Udayangama Attangama, Ashwada, Adino, Nissarana. You have to see that connection. They are discrete, yes, but they are also connected. Udayangama Attangama, Ashwada. Why did Ashwada come after Udayangama Attangama? Why is it not Ashwada, Udayangama Attangama, Adino, Nissarana? It's not like that. It's Udayangama Attangama, then Ashwada, then Adino, then Nissarana. Why so? That's what I'm explaining to you. Until you see Udayangamattanga, which is the arising and passing, until you really see it, until you really understand it, you think that Ashwada comes from elsewhere, from the outside world. But once you begin to understand the Udavima Vayama, this arising and passing away, the Udayangamattanga, once you begin to understand that, now you realize that Ashwada came from nowhere else except from the vexatious Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. You know, really, to put it quite simply, the only reason that you can experience pleasure is because Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana are vexatious. Can you see the irony behind that? You can only experience pleasure because it's vexatious. Why? Because it's vexatious, it passes away, leaving behind attachment. Now you're vexing. Then another set of five come along, and now you're relieved from vexation, leaving you with pleasure. So if they weren't vexatious in the first place, would you have experienced pleasure? No. To put it into an example, a mother can only be happy if her child is also naughty. If the child is not naughty, if the child is not mischievous, now the mother cannot be happy. Why? What is happiness? Relief from vexation. When the child is mischievous, now the mother is vexing. And then the child starts to behave, puts aside all their mischief. Now, relief from vexation and therefore happy. Do you like to be a happy mother? She says she wants to be happy though. So you know what you need to do now. So really, the reason that you can experience pleasure is because Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana are vexatious. If they weren't vexatious, you wouldn't have been able to experience pleasure. So thank heavens, you are able to suffer. If you weren't able to suffer, you wouldn't have been able to experience pleasure. Aren't you glad you can suffer? Aren't you glad you are blessed with the capacity to suffer? It's madness, right? This is mind-blowing. It's complete madness. This is why the Buddha comes and asks us, are you mad? Are you mad to put yourself through this? This happiness that you call happiness is simply relief from suffering. Are you mad to put yourself through that? Why do you say I'd rather have a rash which I can scratch and that makes me feel good? Why do you rather say that when you have the choice of not having the rash in the first place? This is the question that the Buddha asks. You have a choice. Either have a rash, scratch it, now it feels good. Or not have a rash in the first place. Which would you go for? Which would you go for? Have the rash, scratch it, feel good? Or not have the rash in the first place? Not have the rash in the first place, of course. Now you understand the Dhamma, now this is the choice you would go for. So it's because Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana are vexatious. This is why you are able to experience pleasure. If they weren't vexatious, you and I wouldn't be in this room. Because we wouldn't be talking about pleasure. We wouldn't be talking about pleasure if they weren't vexatious. So, Ashwada. Now you know that Ashwada is nothing other than relief from vexation. Pleasure is nothing other than relief from vexation. So, Udayangam, Attangam, Ashwada, Adinam. In the pursuit of pleasure, you have to be willing to accept suffering. Dukkha dukkha, viparinama dukkha and sankara dukkha. You have to be willing to invite these guests into your home if you want to be happy. Who are the guests? Dukkha dukkha, sankara dukkha and viparinama dukkha. You have to be willing to embrace them if you want to be happy. How so? Take the example again. You're vexing. Okay? Someone says, cake. Now you're vexing. to relieve yourself from vexation, you have to do abhisankara, which is either you have to go and bake the cake or you have to go and find cake. So now you have to kick off the abhisankara process of going and finding, seeking cake. And that is not fun. No one likes to make a cake, bake a cake, if they don't find that pleasurable. You only like baking cake because you can eat it. If you didn't, you wouldn't make it. At least for your children. So why do you make it for your children? Because you like to see them happy. That's why. Not seeing them happy vexes you. So to relieve them of their vexation, you bake them a cake. So really, you're only baking them a cake because for your own happiness, not for theirs. For as long as we're only interested in self-preservation, we're not doing anything for somebody else. We're all doing everything we do for our benefit, our well-being, not somebody else's. That's just something we create to feel good about ourselves, not feel bad about the fact that we're all so selfish. Because we don't like to think like that. We don't like to think we are selfish. But the truth is, we are all very selfish. That is the truth. So if you are vexing for cake, then the only thing that can relieve you of that vexation is cake. You want cake, I give you biscuit. Is that good? Are you relieved of your vexation? No. You want strawberry cake, I give you chocolate cake. Are you relieved of your vexation? No. If you are vexed for something, you have to be given that in order to relieve yourself of vexation. Thankfully, so far, you haven't vexed for things that are beyond your reach. What if one day you vex for the moon? Little children, don't they look at the moon? Ami, I want the moon. Now? You'd be like those minions who want the moon. You know, one day if you actually vex for the moon, then the only way that you can get the child to stop crying is by bringing them the moon. There's nothing else that can relieve them of that vexation. Or you have to teach them the way to get rid of that vexation. By teaching them, really Putta, you can't bring the moon because the moon is not something that can be brought to you. You know, it's a massive object that's up in the sky. You know, it's so many millions of miles away, there's no way we can do that. So, you know, you're crying for nothing. You can't be, there's no way we can satisfy you. You have to either explain that to them or bring them the moon. It's one of these two things. What if one day you vex for the queen? Remember, I think last week or the week before I said, a guy peeks over the wall, sees the girl next door, and it's the village thug's daughter. Or the village hitman's wife. Now, if you start vexing for that person, the only way you can be relieved of your vexation is by bringing you that particular object. Because again, it's not the object that you're vexing for, it's the Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. So this is the problem with people, young children these days, getting addicted to pornography. Because what do they see on the internet? It's all fabricated. Right? It's all fabricated. They're acting, they're actors. Who are talented at making you believe in what they want you to believe in. But when your image of what a person's body has to look like is changed depending on what you see on your computer browser, on the internet browser, now this is what you're going to start vexing for. And then what happens? This is what the demand is for. Why do you think young girls these days, they go under the knife? They make changes to their bodies. Why? Because they find that they are no longer in demand. So to be appealing to somebody else, you have to change the way you look so that it appeals to the person who's affection you desire. And they have grown up in a world where their image of a person's body is something that is completely distorted. So if that is what you're vexing for, now, what a disaster. You know, if someone's vexing for a thin person, you can't make them happy by giving them a fat person. And likewise, if someone's vexing for a fat person, you can't make them happy by giving them a thin person. You know, I can't give you elaborate examples. You can think for yourselves. You know, what are some of the things that, you know, on the internet these days that, you know, they get children to vex about? The female figure has been commoditized. All this drushti, views, this is what good looks like. And as soon as that image has been planted in someone's mind, this is what good looks like. In other words, this is ashwad. This is what pleasure looks like. Now the mind starts to vex. Because that, what the child saw as being a beautiful figure is again ultimately Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. So now until this guy is able to receive that Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, this boy is going to be vexing. This guy is going to be vexing. And now he is waiting for the first opportunity to relieve himself of vexation. So he starts to look, what opportunities do I have to relieve myself of vexation? The danger is, there's a sister at home. There's a mother at home. There's a teacher. Best friend. Niece. Aunt. Grandmother. Now, when you're vexing, you have to relieve yourself of vexation. Either you have to relieve yourself of vexation or you have to rid the vexation itself. One of these two things has to happen. Because the longer you're vexing, the intensity of vexation keeps growing. If you draw vexation and time on a graph, the curve is going to be directly proportional. It could be small amounts, but over time it's going to accrue. And the vexation is going to grow. It's going to grow and it's going to become so intense that the slightest opportunity, one sleight of hand, is going to be enough for this child to seek that opportunity to relieve himself of vexation. Because that vexation is going to be burning inside. Moha, ultimately. Waiting for that opportunity to release. You know, imagine if you had a bottle of Coke, you give it a good shake and then leave it. The gas was there all the time, right? But after you've shaken it, now, the moment you take the lid off, now all the liquid is going to pour out. Effervescence. So that's going to happen. The gas was there all the time, but because you have given it a catalyst by shaking it, now the gas has to escape. The pressure inside has, because all the gas has now surfaced to the top of that bottle, now it has to escape. Likewise, when a young child goes through that experience in life, you know, growing up, seeing these distorted views of what the other sex looks like, you know, it applies both ways. Men, women, women, men, both ways. Right? Then this is what you're going to start vexing for. And then over time that vexation is going to grow. It's going to grow in intensity. And it's going to grow so intense that he's not going to be able to wait at least until he gets married. He's not going to be able to wait until he even turns 18. Then he's going to go for the first opportunity he gets, or she gets. And that could be a member of the family. Now, happy days. This is why parents, we keep reminding you, you have to teach your children. You have to give them the gift of Dhamma. Otherwise, they're not going to know any other way other than relief from vexation. Think about your childhood. You didn't know any other way. You didn't know any better. The only thing you knew to do was relieve yourself of vexation. Sometimes when it was not the right thing to do for social decorum. You kept yourself contained. You tried to contain yourself. You tried to discipline yourself, either through fear of punishment or guilt or shame. But now lots of things you can do in secret. Now a lot of things children can do in secret without their parents ever finding out about it. But, you know, when we were growing up, that was not so easy. Everything we did, parents knew. But now that's not the case. Why? You know, the world is so advanced, it's moving at such a rapid pace. Children are being sent on tuition classes every day. Sometimes the tuition master is brought home. So what if your daughter is now vexing for the male touch? And you have the tuition master sat next to her. Now what's going to happen? Now you work out the rest. If all you taught your daughter was to relieve herself of vexation and not to rid the vexation inside the mind by understanding that it's attachment that causes vexation, and therefore, and that attachment is caused by ignorance, that what I'm looking for does not exist in the outside world. If you don't teach your child to do this, all the child knows is, I have to relieve myself of vexation because I just can't bear this. My teacher's next to me. Then all you have to do is look away. Everything else will happen. Back in those, in my days, you know, there was not an opportunity for these things to happen because, you know, we hardly went to tuition classes, I personally. And, you know, the elderly generation would even less so. But now all of that is changing. You know, people have clubs and associations and society. You know, even think about school. How many clubs and societies do they have at school? All good. I'm not complaining about any of them. But all of these are opportunities for your child to go astray. Then think about all the clubs that you have. Music club, right? Dance club, this club, that club. You know, and clubs which entertain social interactions. I used to be a member of Interact Club, Rotaract Club, and these things, Lion Clubs, you know, these. And by the way, I'm not dishonoring anyone by naming any of these clubs. I'm just saying these are things that are out there. And it's okay to get involved. There's nothing wrong with that. What I'm saying is, every time you do get involved, the inevitable is coming your way. If you don't give your child the gift of Dhamma. If all you're interested in is teaching your child, Buddha, go. Go and experience the world. Go and interact with everybody. Go and get to know the world better. Remember, you haven't armed your child with the Dhamma. If you haven't armed your child with the Dhamma, all the child knows is, when I'm vexed, all I'm ready to do is relieve myself of vexation. That's a recipe for disaster. So Abhisankara, when you're in vexation, there is nothing else other than relieving yourself of vexation, and for that you have to do Abhisankara. And that Abhisankara, Dukkha, you have to suffer. You have to embrace with open arms Sankara Dukkha. But no matter what you do, ultimately it's going to pass away. And therefore, Viparinama Dukkha, you have to embrace with open arms. You have to be ready for it. You have to be willing to accept it. If you're telling me, I don't like Sankara Dukkha, I don't like Viparinama Dukkha, well, sorry, you can't experience pleasure then. Yes or no? You can't experience pleasure if you're not willing to experience Sankara Dukkha and Viparinama Dukkha. Yes? You can't have one and not the other two, as well as Dukkha Dukkha. So Dukkha Dukkha, am I able to create what I want? It's that constant feeling of uncertainty. Can I stop this from passing away? That constant feeling of anxiety and uncertainty. Dukkha Dukkha. So Dukkha Dukkha, Sankara Dukkha, Viparinama Dukkha, you can't bid farewell to for as long as you are interested in pleasure, for as long as you want pleasure. You have to let them come in. You have to let them come in. That's why Udayanga Mattangama Ashwada Adinava. Not Adinava and then Ashwada. This is the connection between all of these components. You have to see the connection right from start to end. So first we talked about Udayangam Attangam, arising and passing away. And it is through that process you experience pleasure, ashwada. Okay? Then, although it was ashwada you were so interested in, ultimately you are left with adinava, which is the consequences. Sankara dukkha, viparinama dukkha, and dukkha dukkha. And ultimately, really, when you talk about pleasure, you know now that pleasure is nothing other than a fantasy. It's not something that you have really experienced. It's simply the relief of vexation. Nothing else. Reduction of suffering. Not reduction of suffering and then pleasure brought in additionally as well. It's the reduction of suffering. It's like if you have a loan, if you borrowed 100,000 rupees, you are able to pay off 50,000. Now you have 50,000 pleasure. Are you any richer than you were? No, your loan has just reduced to 50,000. That's all that's happened. It's reduction in suffering, not additional something else coming in as well. And the moment you go down to zero, now you cannot experience pleasure again. It's paying off this debt. That is what pleasure is. It's just debt reducing. Not any more money coming from elsewhere to fill your pockets. Every cent that comes along, you just have to put the other way to pay off your debt. So a man who's in debt cannot be happy about winning the lottery, because all the money he's received has to be paid towards clearing up the debt. Whatever is left over is his money to enjoy with. But that is not how it works with pleasure. When you don't have a debt, you don't have any money coming in. That is the kind of analogy to use in this context. If there's no debt, you won't have money coming in. Likewise, if there's no pain, there's no gain. If there's no suffering, you will not have pleasure. So Udyanga Mattanga Mahashwada Adina, now you begin to understand that what I thought as pleasurable, what I used to think as pleasurable, was simply a complete lie. It's completely false. Complete gimmick. It's nothing. Nothing substantial. All I was left with was dukkha. Dukkha, dukkha, sankara, dukkha, viparinama dukkha, and mountains of it. Lorry loads of it. Truck loads of it. Of dukkha. And that being the case, what is the point in going through in sansara? And when I talk about sansara, we are not necessarily talking about next life. Each chitta is a single unit of sansara. This is the most basic unit of sansara. A chitta arising and passing away. The most basic unit of sansara. So then you begin to ask yourself the question, if every chitta, all I am going through is dukkha, dukkha, sankara, dukkha, viparinama, dukkha, and this falsehood of ashwada, what is the point of me wanting to give rise to another chitta? What is the point? It's pointless, essenceless. That is where anatta comes in. Asar. Essenceless, meaningless, futile. No meaning in doing it. Then you automatically let go. Automatically, not deliberately, it just happens. If you know that something is poisonous, are you not drinking it because I'm forcing you not to drink it? I would have to force you to drink it, not to refrain from drinking it. It's only until you know it's poisonous. Until you know it's poisonous, you're going to drink it. But the day you realize this is poison, you're not going to drink it anymore. If I forced you to, you may have to, because I'm holding your arms down. I'm not leaving you any choice. Hold your mouth and start putting the stuff into your mouth. Then you have no choice. But if you had a choice, you wouldn't even think about it. That is where you don't have to let go. Letting go happens. It's like when the tree does not leave its leaves, when autumn comes along. Is there a leprechaun that goes around every tree and starts shaking all the leaves? No, all the leaves just fall. Why? Because the tree does not need the leaves at that point in its life cycle. Because that's the time the tree needs to preserve the energy that it has within itself. Not feed the leaves. Because there's very little sunlight. So, science lesson to aside, that is what happens. So when the tree does not need the trees automatically falls. No one needs to go and pluck all the leaves. Likewise, when you realize that Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana are essenceless, meaningless, futile, never did it bring me ashwada, never did it bring in pleasure, The only things I ever got for myself was dukkha dukkha, upanam dukkha and sankara dukkha. So simply there was only the pain and no gain. There was only the pain, no gain. When you really begin to understand that, then letting go happens automatically. So that is how Udayanga, Mattanga, Ashwada, Adino, Nisarana happens. In that order. In that order. So you have to contemplate on this now. So when we come to the meditation program, the first half of it, we'll really be spending on contemplating it. Thinking it through. Thinking through the doctrine. So I'll give you a shortened version of this again when we do that. But what you will be doing is thinking it through in your mind. How does that work? Right, so Udayanga, Mattanga, Ashwada, I didn't get that. Let's start again. So this you will be thinking in your mind. By the way, you don't have to close your eyes for that. Keep it open if you like to. But you'll be contemplating on that. But this is something you can do at home as well. So come prepared as much as you can. Because then, once you have gotten the hang of it, what we'll do next is I will be inviting you to think of examples from your own life of the things that you are attached to. Things that bring you pleasure. And then, now you have the doctrine, so or the bar of soap, now start washing your dirty linen. Then you have to just keep washing it until all your linen has been done. How long is that going to take? And the answer is, as long as it takes. As long as it takes. This is why I said right at the start of the sermon, don't be hasty about your destination. Don't be hasty about getting to the destination. That will happen when it happens. What you need to be hasty is to do what you need to do to get to the destination. Because this doesn't happen automatically. That doesn't happen automatically. So you have to practice the Dhamma. Nibbana will happen when it happens. It will happen when it happens. All you need to do is practice. Bhavita Bahulikata. Nibbanaya. I can't remember the rest of it now. Nibbanaya. So I can't hear. Sangvatati. So until you arrive at Nibbana. Nibbanaya Sambodaya Sangvatati. Until you arrive at Nibbana, until you get into Sambodhya, until you arrive at Sambodhi. What is Sambodhi? Bodhi is understanding. Bodhi is understanding. Sambodhi? How this ignorance and attachment are the factors that have kept me bound to samsara. Sangvata. Nibbanaya Sambodhaya Sangvatati. So Nibbana is understanding. Sangvata. So I can't go into the etymology of these things and then that's going to get me in trouble. But it's enough to understand that when you practice this, Bhavita Bahulikata, practice it and practice it regularly. As often as you can. When you continue your practice, then you will arrive at your destination. It's the journey that you need to be concerned about. The destination will happen when it happens. Don't worry about that. So this is what we will do when you come to the meditation program. But like I said, try and find some time at home with your friends. If you know, obviously you have to go, you're gonna have to choose the right friends to do this with. But I think, you know, now you have associates and companionships, right? We are also with people who come along to sermons. So if you can find an opportunity to do that, because unfortunately I don't have the time to do that with each and every one of you. So you can do that among yourselves. Okay? And try and explain to the other person your understanding of the Dhamma. But to do that, ask them for an example. Ask them for a situation to which you have to apply the Dhamma. Otherwise, it's just going to be a lot of Dhamma that I know. You're going to start from Udhyanga Mattangam, so this is Ashwa, this is Adhina, this is Nisana. You're just going to start saying it like a parrot. That is of no use if you can't apply it. You'll be surprised how many people know this A to Z but have no clue on how to apply it. It never fails to amaze me how in every meditation program that we have, sometimes people come and sit in front of us. You know, in like an I know it all way. Yeah, linearly, I know it. So I know it. Go and ask me any question. So that's what they, that's the kind of demeanor that they have when they sit in front. And then I ask you a question. Okay, let me explain to me. Now they're lost. That's not because they don't know. It's because they've never. No, it's like when you make a necklace. Right, all the beads are there. What you have to do is find the right beads and string them along in the right order. That's when you have a beautiful necklace. So what you need to be able to do is find the right bead to go in the right place. Not, here's everything I've got, you decide what you have to do with it. That's not how it works. You have to be able to give the right medicine for the right patient, for the right disease. Otherwise you walk into the pharmacy, here's all the drugs I've got, help yourself. That doesn't work, because the patient has no idea of how drugs work. You're the pharmacist, so you have to be able to prescribe or rather give the right, dispense the right drug. And likewise, if you have the Dhamma, you have to be able to do this. Otherwise, the problem is this: when you sit down for meditation, you will not have a clue about how to apply the Dhamma. You will know a lot of Dhamma but not how to apply it, because you haven't practiced it. So you have to practice this. So find an opportunity at home to do this before you come. Okay. Perhaps in future we'll try and organize a way where we can discuss with you, but it's going to take a long time because we simply don't have the resources right now. So when you try to explain to somebody, if you get stuck somewhere, that's a good thing. Yes or no? If you get stuck somewhere, that's a good thing. Because now you know, at this point I'm going to stumble. I don't know how to get myself out of this. So therefore now you have a question mark there. And that question mark you have to address. This is why I'm telling you straight, you know, already. Because we're going to be doing it at the end of the month. So I'm telling you this already because now you can start practicing it. Do it a few times and then you'll have several question marks. Those questions bring along to, along to the sermons. So we can cover them during the sermon in preparation for the meditation program. Because the meditation program is not the time to answer those questions. We can do them now so that when we come along to the program, you will know exactly what to do. Is that fair enough? Okay. Is it already 7:15? Good heavens. I completely lost track of time. I'm sorry. Okay. So we'll reflect on the Arya Maitreya and we'll close the bring the sermon to an end after we have transferred merits. Is it in English this time? Or Sinhala? English?
May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of birth, freed from the fire of decay, freed from the fire of illness, freed from the fire of death, freed from the fire of sorrow, freed from the fire of lamentation, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. Healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of suffering, freed from the fire of discontentment, freed from the fire of exhaustion, freed from the fire of disappointment, freed from the fire of clinging on to the five aggregates, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. Healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. Healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the suffering of samsara, freed from the disease of samsara, freed from the fear of samsara, freed from the fire of samsara, freed from the burning of samsara, freed from the flames of samsara, freed from the sorrow of samsara, freed from the lust of samsara, freed from the clutches of samsara, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. Healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. Healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. The karma worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from the karma worlds. The rupa worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from the rupa worlds. The arupa worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from the arupa worlds. All worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from all the worlds. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Letting go is the only salvation. May I and all beings let go. Detachment is the only salvation. May I and all beings be detached. Being freed is the only salvation. May I and all beings be freed. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the bondage of lust, freed from the bondage of aversion, freed from the bondage of delusion, freed from the bondage of Mara, healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana, healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana, healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana, healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana. Healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana. Healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana.
Okay. As a closing remark,
Make it your life's purpose, your life's goal to get membership of that exclusive club. Don't die until you have become a member. Because in your next birth, you might not be able to become one. Remember, this is by invitation only. So you are all invited. Just have to ask yourself, are you prepared to become a member? For one, you have to let go of your citizenship of the four great hells. You will get permanent citizenship, citizenship of the Sugati worlds, the blissful plane. But you have to want to get out of this place as soon as possible. You get out of the 31 realms of existence as soon as possible. So get membership of this exclusive club. There is no club that is more exclusive than this. Not all the money in the world, not all the knowledge you have, not all the power you have can get you membership of this club. You have to have wisdom and you have to have the association of noble ones to become a member of the noble club. Make it your life's purpose. That's a good resolve to have in the new year. I think there was one gentleman who last year said his resolve was to become a Sotapanna by the end of the year. I still remember. You know, things like that you say always sticks with me when I can see that you're serious about it. Don't be kidding with me. Because I can see if you're serious or not. Okay? You have to be serious. This is not fun and games. This is serious stuff. Okay. Let's transfer merits and then we'll close the sermon. First and foremost, let us once again take a moment to reflect on the fact that it is because of the supremely enlightened Buddha that we have the gift of Dhamma today. It is thanks to him. It is because of his infinite compassion for all sentient beings that we have the gift of Dhamma today. Also, let us take a moment to transfer merits to the Bhikkhu Bhikkhunis Upasaka Upasikas who from the time of the Buddha all the way up until now have protected and preserved the Dhamma. It is thanks to them that today we have the Tripitaka which we can study, analyze, understand and comprehend, as well as their relentless effort to protecting and preserving the Sambuddha Shasane. It is because of them today we are able to be in the association of noble ones. We are able to be in the association of the Mahasangha who have dedicated their lives to practicing the Dhamma as well as disseminating the Dhamma for the benefit and deliverance of all sentient beings. May they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. Particularly at this point in time, let us not forget to transfer merits that we have acquired today to the members of the Mahasangha who are resident in your local temples and nunneries, monks and nuns who are resident there, including the chief incumbent monks as well as the novice monks who are resident in those temples and nunneries. It is thanks to them that you have been able to send your children to Dhammapasala as well as live a happy life up until this point in life. It is they who have dedicated time out of their lives to helping you out at times of hardship, through thick and thin, through rain and shine, they've always been by your side to help you, to guide you. Let us take a moment to transfer merits to them as well. As well as the chief incumbent monk of the Sri Dhanan Methiniarame who has kindly allowed you to use the temple premises for your parking purposes as a rendezvous. May he also, as well as the other members of the temple or other monks resident in the temple, be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. May through the power of all these merits, if any of them have today been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits, they redeem themselves from the woeful plains and be born in the blissful plains, may through the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the devas, brahmas, spirits, demons and the dead that we invited at the start of this sermon, as well as all those beings who will have been mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces and so on and so forth, husbands, wives, children, teachers, and as well as anyone who might have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form in this infinitely long journey in samsara. Anyone and everyone we might owe debt to, may they all be able to rejoice the merits that we have all acquired today. May through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they be able to redeem themselves from those woeful plains and be born in the blissful plains. May through the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to all the monks of this monastery, including Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the Anagarikas who are resident at the monastery. It is thanks to them that today you are able to come along and make use of the facilities that are available here, as well as our monks and our Anagarikas who have taken great effort to make your stay here as comfortable as they can, including by not only but also providing these sermons to our online audience so that they can listen to these sermons no matter where in the world they may be at this point in time, as well as arranging this stage and decorating this stage as a veneration to the Dhamma. May they also rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. May through the power of these merits they all be able to fulfill the noble eightfold path, abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to all those men and women in your lives who have helped you to be here today, members of your family, as well as your co-workers, those who have taken on your duties and responsibilities and such relieved you of those duties and responsibilities so that you are able to be here today. Members of your family as well as members of your workplace, your co-workers, may they all be rejoicing in the merits that we have all acquired today. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who fought a 30-year long war in Sri Lanka. It is thanks to them that today we have a country in which we can live in peace and harmony and practice the Dhamma without the fear of death looming around. If any of them have today been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits they be able to redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plains. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to men and women who might have lost their lives in natural calamities such as the tsunamis, earthquakes, not just in Sri Lanka but also in other parts of the world. Some of them may be your acquaintances, some may be family, some may be friends, but also the majority will be men and women who will have been your mothers, fathers in your previous births. So may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. May through the power of all these merits they redeem themselves from the woeful plains, be born in the blissful plains, and may through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may through the course of all this sermon, may through all the power of all the merits that we have all acquired today in preparing for this sermon, in taking the efforts to be here today, as well as helping other people to be here today, as well as other meritorious deeds you might have conducted throughout the day, perhaps by ushering someone to a seat, offering someone a glass of water, or perhaps by making their stay here as comfortable as it can be, doing whatever it is that you could have done to help make this event a success. May through the power of all the merits that we have all acquired today, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahatan Mahanses in this blessed land, in our very lives itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And may you and I and everyone and anyone who might have contributed to making this event a success, either locally or internationally, anyone and everyone who are listening to this sermon today and also at some point in the future, may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today, and may they all be able to become one of those Arahatan Mahanses, one of those Arahat Mihinin Mahanses in this birth itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midetva, dvesha ginnen midetva, moha ginnen midetva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita taravetma.
තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයන් නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතිතර වෙත්වා. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fires of desire. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fires of aversion. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fires of delusion. May I and all beings in all worlds attain the supreme bliss of nibbana. May the noble triple gem be with you all forever. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.